Lagunitas founder Tony McGee. From the fashion blog Red Souls and Red Wine, Jennifer Werman. And another installment of the Swap Meet with Greg Flam. And now, here's your host, a man who wore his best romper today, Justin Kaufman.
So breezy. You know, just a one piece, a onesie, if you will. I mean, you really don't even have to take them off to go to the bathroom. I mean, they're equipped for you to just go. I love that's going around, that that's part of a romper. Guys won't even have to go to the bathroom. They just go right in the romper. Gross. That being said, I'm getting three. I'm going to go over to the Macy's. Whenever the male romper comes out, I will gladly take my misshapen, pear-like body and be a model for its future. You know, right now you see the models, it's all these sort of young, strapping, 25-year-old millennial dudes. How about putting a romper in a 42-year-old guy who does a radio talk show with curves? It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a fantastic show lined up. We're going to get right to it. Tony McGee is going to be my guest tonight at the big table, the owner and founder of Lagunitas Beer. Of course, they made big news past week, sale to Heineken. We'll talk about whether or not selling out or what Tony says buying in. Have that conversation coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Also tonight, we got to talk fashion. I'm surprised when something like this happens, when you get this story about a piece of clothing, a style, if you will. Just the outrage, the pushback, if you will, the sort of commentary that everybody has on what other people wear. Jennifer Werman's going to join us tonight. She's got the blog Red Souls and Red Wines, popular. She was just in Splash Magazine this weekend. We'll talk to her about fashion. And also this project, this man romper, is a Chicago thing. So we'll talk about Chicago's role in new fashions, the fashion scene, and her take on what we're seeing for the summer. Also tonight, Greg Flam, the Swap Meet. Of course, 312-981-7200, my favorite segment of the week, where we evaluate your junk. Yeah. And Mike Fouché will be here to talk about the grand bargain. The grand bargain. And where we are in Springfield. The Senate passed a budget, but then the second vote didn't go through. It's just, it just gives me heartburn thinking about this. We'll break it all down with Mike Fouché coming up after the 7:30 news. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by my man Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, let's take a break. Come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, here are today's top stories. President Trump told Gold Coast Coast Guard graduates, sorry about that, today that they have to fight adversity, put their heads down, and that he is treated so unfairly, the worst than any other politician in American history. So if that's not motivation enough for you to go out and guard our waterways, then something is wrong with you. Trump went on to say that essentially this is all happening because he is fighting the establishment in Washington. And to me, that might be part of the problem. Yes, you were elected to change things in D.C., but breaking rules, destroying decorum, and the utter disrespect of the office may be a misinterpretation of your mandate. It's not your company, bud. It's ours. So you can't go and put a row of blackjack tables in the Senate floor or use the House grocery money to buy WrestleMania, right? I get it. It's like Caddyshack. You're the Rodney Dangerfield, and Washington, D.C. is Ted Knight. But in the end, the whole entire golf course explodes. Yeah, I mean, there is Caddyshack too, but even you, Mr. President, would recognize that's just a crappy movie. I think all we ask for here is respect. Just read the employee handbook. You can't give away secrets. You can't fire people who are investigating you. You can't wear those golf pants all the time. Okay? Back to D.C. drama. It's official. Former FBI Director Robert Mueller is being brought in by the Justice Department to investigate Trump's ties to Russia. So the Dems get their wish, and a former Obama guy too. I just hope he's as charismatic as Ken Starr. Ken Starr. You remember that? Remember a simpler time in American government? Ken Starr. In Springfield, the Senate Democrats have started to dismantle the grand bargain. And instead, now they're calling for a tall bargain. Starbucks reference there. The Dems are even going as far as to recall bills that have already been voted on to have them voted on again. The idea of the grand bargain was that both parties would sign on to all bills, even ones that weren't very much liked by either side, one or the other. But then Governor Rauner and Republicans backed out of that idea. So now Dems are just going to pass what they like and stay away from what they don't. So essentially, it's rerun season in Springfield. And there's nothing worse than seeing the same episode of Kings of Queens over and over and over. And then they did it. They balanced the budget. It's passed. We're on our way. It's over. And it was one that was originated by Republicans? Yeah, right. But then there was a secondary vote to implement, which I didn't even know existed. That failed. Springfield. You're like a old, worn-out playground seesaw. It goes back and forth, but watch out for a bruised tailbone. Or worse, splinters. Although I guess passing a budget is progress, but somehow in Illinois, it's the exact opposite. It just seems more like pressure. Can't wait for the budget to make it to the House, then pass, and then get vetoed, and then watch the folksy political ads for the 2018 gubernatorial election from millionaire candidates. Speaking of millionaire, Chicago millionaire Ken Griffin gave $20 million to Governor Bruce Rauner today because the rich, well, they've been forgotten in this country and they just want to be heard. Also, this money's for the 2018 election. Man, time is flying by. Can you believe that we're only 3 months away from being 6 months from the primary? That's really, we're right there. McDonald's announced today they're expanding their delivery options. They're going to make their food available for delivery services. So if you need a Big Mac and you just don't have it in you to go to the drive-thru or actually into the store, then, well, maybe what they say about you is true, right? Think about that. In weather, hot again. Not 90 degrees hot, but hot. Also, rain and tornado watches. It's like we just skipped early summer and we're right into mid-August. That's how the politicians would like it. In sports, the Cubs get back in the win column yesterday behind rookie phenom Ian Happ. How many rookie phenoms can this team have in a couple years? Jeez. He blasted his first homer at Wrigley last night, and he's playing again tonight. He's playing ball. And that just might put him back in AAA. Hayward's near a return, so there are some that say he might have to adjust to playing corner infield to spell Bryant and Rizzo, just to justify him staying in the bigs. The Cubs go tonight. They're playing right now, trying to make it two in a row against the Reds. Also last night was Joe Maddon's 1,000th victory as a Major League Baseball manager. And that's hard to do, especially when you bring your closer in the seventh inning. I couldn't resist. The White Sox, well, we're in the middle of it. It's the June swoon, a month early. We were excited that the rebuilding Sox might have a spark after their successful month in April, and they rewarded our interest by losing 8 of their last 10. They lost to the Angels again last night. They hope to salvage one tonight so they aren't swept out of Anaheim. Anaheim. After tonight, they head to Seattle. Seattle. They're currently three back of the upstart Twins. The Twins. They're just mediocre baseball all the way around. In basketball, rumors swirl around Jimmy Butler because last night, the Boston Celtics got the number one pick in the NBA lottery. Celtics have been long rumored to be interested in trading for a superstar like Jimmy Butler, but haven't been able to pull the trigger. Now, as they enter the Eastern Conference Final as the number one seed, many argue their window is now, not 5 years from now, and they need to trade that pick. Enter the Bulls, whose window is plexiglass and doesn't open at all. So the Bulls could be in play for the number one overall in the NBA draft this year, which many sources say is super mediocre. So once again, the Chicago team has a chance at a top pick when nobody else wants it. I'd like to see them move up from the number one if they could. I don't know. The Bulls, Gar and Pax will figure out a way to move up. The Celtics are at home to host the Eastern Conference Finals, which start tonight against LeBron, Braun, and the Cavs. The Warriors won game two easily against the Spurs last night. They got a 2-0 lead. Also, Pau Gasol's on the Spurs. That's all I got. I saw it because I watched a highlight, and I saw Pau Gasol lose a loose ball. I'm like, oh, yay. A former Bull. All right. And finally tonight, carjackings are on the rise in Chicago. Teens are targeting high-end luxury vehicles using old-school tactics like bump-and-run scams and taking cars by gunpoint, which is exactly why I have kept my 2005 Honda. You really want to fake an accident to steal my cassette player? Have at it, Hoss. That's the carryout for May 17, 2017. Hey, it's windy, so we've given you 1,000 napkins so you can just let them swirl all around. La, la, la. right, coming up, Mike Fouché. Talk about the grand bargain in Springfield. Some other stories happening right here. A good, interesting story about how Mayor Emanuel's city council isn't as rubber stamp as it used to be. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
I just want to thank the President of the United States once again for keeping the newsroom alive and pumping. It's good. I like it.
Presidents are good for that.
Actually, you know what's been funny is that we're starting to get a little tired of all of it. And, you know, we're supposed to be on top of it and, you know, kind of keep everything out in front of us. It's just coming so fast now. It's crazy.
Well, it's almost like there was a... The gauntlet was thrown down to the major news outlets earlier in the week when they said, "Ooh, this is a big story," and Trump said, "Oh, I've got tapes," and it was like, "I wonder what they're going to do." And here they all come with all their stories, and it's just one after another, and it's exhausting as an American, I'll tell you that.
I feel like taunting James Comey was not a pro move.
Right. If you're gonna taunt somebody, don't taunt the FBI.
I mean, this
director.
Guy actually already went to the mat with his notes in order to get another attorney general. The whole case where a bunch of people tried to get Ashcroft to sign something,
he was there.
And it was his notes. So
I agree. And then even, I mean, Rob, Ro, and Anna talking about the transcripts of this meeting,
right? I'm a simple guy, as you know. I just go back to when Trump won the election.
Yeah.
You won the election. Now move forward.
Yeah.
But every time he opens his mouth, today was another prime example. He's giving the commencement speech. He just cannot help himself.
Right. I know.
And in talking about how battered he's been.
You know what? Adversity, keep your head down, fight, and I'm treated so poorly. Right? That's
it.
A commencement speech.
It would be
better
if he did it like in a Rodney Dangerfield
kind
of voice.
That's what I'm saying. Like, we just make
it. Hey, you know what? Hey.
I mean, a guy who has a gold toilet, I have a hard time feeling sorry for. You know what I mean? That's all.
Nice.
That's
hold
that's
the line,
the
daily line. I like that. That's smart. Free association there, Pete. I like that.
I like that.
Mike Fouché in
it's
studio
a song
tonight.
I know.
There you go. Of course, the man behind the daily line. Get at thedailyline.net. Covers everything.
I am the man behind the daily line because the other two people at the daily line are women.
There you go.
So that you know.
See, I choose my words carefully.
Yeah. Right.
All right, Mike. Let's talk about Springfield because you cover Chicago, you cover Springfield. We'll talk about both tonight. Let's first talk about the grand bargain. The bargain kind of fell apart.
Grande bargain. I'll have one of those, please.
So let's talk about this because you know we heard last week State Senate President John Cullerton say, "I'm throwing my hands up. This isn't going to work. I feel like the governor's getting involved and he's breaking it up. So we're going to go back to the old way and we're just going to pass what we want."
Well, I mean, that's not entirely true. I mean, what they did is that I think they really tried to do a lot of things that he wanted, including they include a permanent property tax freeze, which Rauner has insisted on having a permanent property tax freeze. But Cullerton is saying, look, you know, if we have a permanent property tax freeze, that is the number one way that schools are funded. And, you know, right now, and we've talked about this before, pretty much if you're in Cook County south of I-55.
It's terrible.
It's a nightmare.
30%.
Everything's going to crash really soon. All those schools are going to go bankrupt.
But there are other places in Illinois where it's not as bad.
Right.
And Chicago being one of them.
But also, particularly, most of the states south of I-80 and outside of the collars are really hurting with property taxes. And schools are doing okay with that stuff. So, you know, that's really who Rauner's speaking to here, everybody outside of Chicago and the collars.
Right, right.
And, you know, yeah, I mean, what Cullerton did was kind of a legislative move where rather than moving everything as one big package, they broke it up into little pieces so everybody gets to vote for what they like and don't like. And it's a big, giant mess and nothing really
moving. Explain to me, I had a hard time wrapping my little brain around this.
It is little.
Yeah, but the concept of they passed a balanced budget. And they said, okay, here's our budget. And,
right.
And like you just said, it had some things that the Republicans, Rauner included, initiated or wanted in the budget.
Right.
And then there was a second vote that was an implementation.
Implementation. So, I mean,
I didn't know they did that.
Well, they don't have to. It's just that's how this was set up. Normally, it can be part of one thing, or maybe you just have a second.
I thought you passed a bill and it moved to the House, right?
And you just have the second thing. Well, these are big pieces. There's lots of different pieces, and typically what's done is that they are all passed with they're voted on with the understanding that they all have to be passed in order to be enacted. And Culleton broke this up into different little pieces so that everybody could vote on what it is that they like. And so the enacting clause, essentially the implementation part, didn't pass, which gave people an opportunity to say, I voted for it, but they also get to say, I voted against it at the same time.
Is that by design? I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. So everybody gets a twofer. You know, you can have your cake and eat it too.
So this was a political maneuver by...
Well, everything in a legislature is political.
I'm saying the idea of saying that you could pass a budget.
Yeah.
That's just to say that you did. So when someone's going to put together a commercial...
Right.
For a 2018,
that's exactly
you could say,
right.
Well, we passed the
budget. I voted for it. And then they could also say, but I voted against it.
Well, yeah, exactly. Senator Chapin Rose just tweeted out, Republican senator said, we need a balanced budget with reforms that will put Illinois on sound financial footing. The budget advanced today by the other side of the aisle is neither balanced nor a long-term solution to what ails our state. That sounds like Rauner speak. And it surprises me because you just told us that there are some things in this budget that the Republicans wanted.
Yeah, and also stuff on workers' comp. I mean, there were a lot of agreement on changes to workers' comp that Rauner has been asking for. They agreed to an income tax increase at an amount that Rauner agreed to. The Democrats wanted a lot more. They stuck with 4.95%.
So then why is a Republican senator coming out with a statement that is – pretty much party line.
It's a mystery to me. I mean, I
can understand not liking it because maybe you don't want a tax increase, but this that statement just speaks of
party
politics.
It's an absolute mystery to me. But you know, let's take a look at this other. There's a whole other piece that happened today that's really fascinating that it happened on the same day, which is that Ken Griffith, the richest man in Illinois,
right,
wrote a $20 million check to Bruce Rauner today. Which means that Bruce Rauner now has $71 million in his campaign account.
Yeah.
That is so much money. Just to put it into perspective, if you were going to run TV commercials all over the state for a week and you wanted to saturate carpet bomb, it would cost you about $1.5 million. So that would mean that, I mean, roughly he now has enough money for almost a whole year.
Well, it's amazing to think about
saturation carpet bombing commercials.
Ken Griffin's been in the news, of course. He only made $600 million this past year, which is down from over $1 billion that he usually
makes.
That's
a shame.
And he jumps $20 million. Now, it's not a secret that he has been in Republican politics in the past. The question I have, and I was talking to Pete beforehand, is, I mean, it's okay, so he's putting $20 million in. So then I guess on the other side, you've got Pritzker and Kennedy, and they're going to find hedge fund operators that are liberals, and they're going to put $20 million in. I mean, are we just saturating the market? Are the people who are running for office, I mean, are they just putting way too much money into something that is pretty simple?
Well, hold on a minute. I mean, let's just talk about Rauner for a moment, and then we can talk about the Democrats. The truth is that Bruce Rauner has effectively been, for the last 2 years, the campaign finance fundraising machine for Illinois Republicans. Illinois Republicans have really, in a lot of ways, stopped raising their own money.
Right.
And Bruce Rauner has pretty much said, I'm going to take care of you, and you have to do what it is that I say. Now, isn't it interesting that he gets this big $20 million injection on the day of the budget vote? I mean, I think that sends a heck of a message to every Republican in the legislature.
What's the message? The message is, I have the money. If you mess this up, I'm not going to fund
you. I'm the boss. I mean, I think that's the case. And
So don't get out of line. Don't step out of line. Don't start making deals with the Democrats just because of the pressure of May. We haven't had a budget in 3 years. Stay in the lane. And I've got the money that says
stay in the lane. Stay in the lane. I'll make sure you stay.
I'll pay the tolls.
Yeah.
Right? Stay in the lane. I'll pay the tolls.
That's right. Boy, that is a catchphrase.
Mike Fouché, thedailyline.net in studio for his Wednesday check-in. We're talking politics. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. We continue our conversation with Mike Fouché as we've been I don't want to say arguing, but we're getting heated in the break here.
We're getting fired up.
I don't understand. What I don't understand is if Governor Rauner wanted to get past reforms with a turnaround agenda, and he asked for these things from Democrats, and today the state Senate compromises and gives some of those things to him, how can he not claim that as a victory? Why are you seeing talking points come out from Republicans, senators who say, this is another thing, the Democrats are just unbalanced, this, that, and the other, when it seems to be chock full of things that Rauner wanted?
Well, I mean, I think it all goes back to the original thing that Bruce Rauner rolled out when he first became governor, which is the turnaround agenda, where he wants Illinois to be a right-to-work state. He wants to eliminate property taxes.
By all means necessary. I mean, we're not doing any compromise. This is the way we're going to do it, and everything else is
He wants to eliminate public sector unions. And one of the things that we've seen from Bruce Rauner before he became governor, in emails that he has, that we've seen to other people about different things, is that he is a believer that you have to bring the opponent absolutely to heel. You have to crush them in order to be able to get what it is that you want. This is not a conspiracy. This is how he has done business, and he has written emails. There's a series of emails about to Rahm Emanuel before he became governor, talking about how CPS needed, the teachers union needed to be brought to heel. And so understanding that and about his thinking, you know, I think what we're seeing here is the implementation of that sort of thinking. What he has said is that in order for the Republican plan to succeed, for the conservative plan to succeed, everything that the Democrats hold dear, all the social programs, all the social services, have to be obliterated.
That just seems, I mean, Mike, and I know you to be objective, and I know you to be someone at the Daily Line. It just seems to be hyperbole, right? It's something that you can't believe that a politician would be like, here's my plan. Destroy everything that we have right now. We'll figure it out after.
You know, it's one of the things that makes it really difficult when you're a reporter and you encounter these people that are sort of larger in life, not only Bruce Rauner, but also Donald Trump, and have these visions that are just really kind of off the charts about how to do things. And it's hard to talk to people. It's hard to write about it. It's hard to describe it as a reporter because it's just so out of, you know, what everybody else would talk about. But I mean, from what I can see, and I've been around the horn a few times, I mean, I think this is really what Bruce Rauner is attempting to do. I do believe it.
All right, let's move on to something local. You know, there's a lot with Mayor Emanuel, and there was a good article about how the City Hall is becoming less of a rubber stamp for the mayor. Something new for Chicago.
Yeah.
How about that, right?
A little bit.
But Dorothy Brown, I want to talk about the clerk of the circuit court in Cook County.
Clerk of the courts,
Dorothy Brown. Dorothy Brown, anyone who's paying attention to Chicago politics knows Dorothy Brown's name usually comes up in some sort of trouble. There'll be a headline of some investigation, or I remember one time she was in trouble for having you could put money in and you could wear jeans on Friday.
You gave her money.
But then nobody knows where that money went.
Right, like exactly.
She's
a tip jar.
She's, once again, her chief of staff is in for a jobs for fundraising investigation. What's happening here?
Her chief of staff was called. Today there were all kinds of rumors going around City Hall and the county building. You know, something Dorothy Brown, Dorothy Brown. Nobody really knew what it was. And then later in the afternoon, it emerged that Dorothy Brown's chief of staff has been called before a grand jury for questioning. Dorothy Brown has not been implemented or not. She hasn't been said that she has done anything wrong, but her chief of staff is being questioned. There is another case that's moving through her office right now about somebody, or I'm sorry, moving through the DOJ. That somebody in her office was running an operation where they would raise, if you raised money for Dorothy Brown's campaign, then you would get extra consideration for promotions in her office, which, you know,
in the '60s was Chicago,
right? You know, right? I mean, you know, once back in the day, old man Daly said, if you can't help out your son, you know, what can you do?
Right.
But, you know, I don't know. Dorothy Brown's version is, if you can't help out the people that are raising money for you, what can you do?
It's just old school politics. It's what people have targeted Chicago to when they say the machine.
So, you know, it looks like the heat continues to rise on her. And, you know, it's fascinating to me because on the one hand, there are all these investigations that continue to keep popping up for Dorothy Brown. But whenever I go to any kind of a community meeting in the Black South Side, especially, Dorothy Brown shows up. It's amazing. She's everywhere. And she has an absolute sense of what is important and not important in the Black South Side, Chicago.
Well, she's been a very popular politician for the African American community for a while.
Yeah.
And she has, you know, withstood investigations, and we'll see what happens with this one, including some other things or business dealings that some of the people involved with her had. I mean, there's a lot on the table, but she's still in office, and she's still, I guess, is the clerk of the circuit court.
Yeah, and, you know, I know a lot of attorneys that just despise the clerk of the court's office. I mean, the Cook County legal system in terms of managing cases is incredibly decrepit and old. You have to really fight through the system to look stuff up.
Right.
And it's slow. They lose cases all the time, you know. And, like, if you go look, one of my reporters used to work in New York City. And when she first started working in Chicago trying to look up this stuff, she said, "Are you kidding me? Is this a joke?"
For a long time, it was paper trail. I mean, I heard Pappas talking about this. The idea that for a long time, Tom Dart talks about it, the idea that there would be a piece of paper that would follow an inmate.
Right.
A Cook County, jail inmate.
Yeah.
And if you lost that paper, well, okay, then I guess the guy can go. Like,
right.
It's like, what? They essentially, like, hand the paper, like, tape it on his back.
And the truth is still, if you want to go get something about it, well, if you want to get something about a brief or something for a case in the Cook County courts, you have to go down there and go get it and pay for the copies. Whereas you do that in other major counties, you can just go online. Zoop, there it is.
Mike Fouché, The Daily Line, joins us every Wednesday. Follow the podcast as well. Aldercast, which is here on WGN Plus, comes out on Fridays. All right, next week's a big week because we're down to the last 2 weeks of Springfield, so we got a lot to talk about next week. Mike Fouché, great to see you, bud.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, it was announced recently that Lagunitas, one of Chicago's biggest and best craft breweries, would sell their stake to Heineken. Heineken had already owned 50%, but this move makes them 100% owners. What's that mean for the California transplant that we've come to love so much here in the Midwest? Well, for one thing, global representation. And that's a good enough trade-off for founder Tony McGee. McGee is the man who created Lagunitas in his kitchen 24 years ago. And he's grown the beer and the brand to not only have a brewery in here in Chicago, but a brand new facility under construction, just about ready, in California. Tony McGee is my guest tonight at the big table to talk about beer, buying in, and labels, all sorts of labels. Tony McGee, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's first talk about this, the acquisition. I mean, this was something a couple of years ago, you gave 50% up and now 100%.
That's right.
What's behind this?
Well, I've been at this for, you said, 24 years, and it's been a ton of heavy lifting over the years, and it's a big job. We've gotten the business this year. We'll do 1,010,000 barrels. It's a big number when you think about it.
Yeah.
That each of those kegs is 13 cases, and so the business has gone a long way, and we've pioneered things that that we're proud to contribute it. And you do the work on a thing for long enough, after a while, you start to notice that you're solving a lot of the same problems over and over again. And that's work that you can pass on to others within the business to do. And so I've always tried to keep myself out on the bow of the boat and not doing the repetitive things, but trying to figure out where do we go from here? Where do we go next? And, the Heineken relationship in the first place was an effort to begin to, like, really engage ourselves with the larger world of beer.
Do you have to make a decision as an owner when you have a brand like Lagunitas, which is really taken off? Everyone knew it in California, but comes to Chicago now. You see it everywhere. I mean, it's really going somewhere. Do you have to make a decision as an owner, as a founder, whether or not you want to be the one that expands that brand globally, or if you give it to somebody else?
In this case, I will be the one to expand it globally. Heineken will be my partner to get it done. So there's a lot of things about a business. There's the stock. Who owns the stock? Well, that's the person who owns the beneficial economic interest of the enterprise. But that's a very different thing from the enterprise. And the people that are Lagunitas actually are the brand. They live it. It is a manifestation of us. And so the relationship we were able to strike with Heineken, which is different from any other brewer that we could have done in the United States, particularly ABI or even, you know, the sort of local Miller Coors, or Constellation, for that matter, in the Modelo business, is that they recognize that we know how to do things that they don't do and that they need desperately to mm-hmm. become involved with. And so we're actually the keys to the kingdom.
How do you prevent, when they have 100% ownership, how do you prevent them messing with you guys, changing the – we don't like the way Lagunitas looks. We don't like the way it tastes. We don't like right. the way it – you know, everything in between. How do you prevent that from happening?
Well, we're partners, and we behave as partners. How did I prevent Lagunitas from failing for 24 years in a row? Is by partnering with consumers. You know, is there a contract between me and consumers? No. You know, we have to find out, tune into what beer lovers are thinking, and anticipate their dreams, and try to deliver adventure to them. And so the whole thing is always. It's always a tightrope walk, you know, up high, you know, over the street and without a net. And so this is the same thing. The way I prevent them from doing that is by being a leader within their organization, by taking them places that surprise them and doing things that make it very clear that Lagunitas is in and of itself valuable and the people who inhabit it. And so far, so good.
I mentioned global representation in the lead. I mean, that's a big part of what this is about, the idea that Lagunitas can expand itself beyond just this market or California or the American market, for that matter, to Europe, other places. I mean, is that something that has always been on your mind?
No. We grew, and I mean, I remember back in, I don't know, the early 2000s, looking, turning to Ron Lindebusch, my marketing director at the time, and saying to Ron, you know, what are we trying to do? Are we trying to be a national brand? You know, and it was like, but, you know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And mm-hmm. so we took one step after another. And next thing you know, we found ourselves in all 50 states. And there's still a lot of work to do within those 50 states to meet more people and to find more retailers. But that job now I can turn over to others to finish. And so I look up and I'm like, well, what's beyond this? And I see oceans on either side of the country. And I see a whole nother country nobody even thinks about selling craft beer into the South. And so, you know, there's opportunities that are larger than what we're currently doing. And that's my job, is to dream.
Tony McGee's my guest, the founder of Lagunitas. We're talking about the recent sale to Heineken. I think about...
You know, sale, that's funny.
I know it's a weird name. I don't know any other... Would you say acquisition?
Well,
what would you say?
So I described it as buying in. One person said to me, you know, they realized what we'd actually done was we married into the family. Mm-hmm. You know, Heineken is family-owned, actually, family-controlled. There's a woman named Charlene Heineken. Her oldest son, Alexander, has been on my board of directors for the last 2 years. So, I mean, these are real people that control a real global company.
Looking at that, I mean, the opposite of buying in, if indie craft is selling out. I mean, how do you... What do you tell the people when someone says, well, that just sounds like a traditional craft beer that sold out to the big dogs?
Beer lovers care. That's the opportunity in what we do, and it's also one of the burdens, is that they care very deeply and have a very intense personal ownership. There's no two ways about it. It's why craft exists, is that personal ownership that beer lovers have taken in brands. And so to them, I just have to say, just watch, you know, watch what we do next, and watch. And if we lose your faith, then shame on us. But since we began the Heineken relationship, people then called, sell out, and they called the, you know, foul, and said the beer would become, you know, we'd start putting it in green bottles. But instead, you know, we rolled out, you know, Citrus Anisus and Born Yesterday, the fresh hop ale, and then Born Again Yesterday, you know, and we keep with the one hitters doing the high westified stouts and stuff. You have to earn your stripes every day. And so I would just say, be patient and watch what happens next.
Craft beer has always been, you know, as a layman paying attention to it, it's a very regional experience. You go to Denver, Colorado, and you open up the case, and
there
are beers you've never seen if you're from Chicago, and the same everywhere.
Yeah, that's right.
How do you find yourself competing against that? Because that essentially, they're going for local markets, and here comes Lagunitas in all 50 states, not to mention Europe. Other places are going to have, I guess, territorialism, if you will, when it comes to the beer.
Well, you know, people use that word compete a lot within craft, and I've never seen us as competing within craft. I think we all fish in the same pond. But the one of the beautiful things about it is that it's a niche industry in more ways than not. And when you're in an industry like that, you don't have to appeal to everybody. You need to find people that you have something in common with. And beer lovers, I think my brother-in-law pointed this out. He does the Cicerone program is his business. The consumers actually drink from a portfolio of beers. And your job as a brewer is to try to be as close to the center of that portfolio as you can be. And so I recognize that, you know, we're not in an either-or world. It's a both-and world. And so we share customers with each other.
Tony McGee is the founder of Lagunitas. We're talking about the great craft beer that's here in Chicago as well in California. And we'll continue to talk about the brewery that's opening up in California. But just the idea of, as a business, how you maintain two different locations coming up here after the break. In studio, Tony McGee. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio at the big table, Tony McGee. He's a longtime founder of Lagunitas. In the intro, I said 24 years, and it was you came up with it on the stovetop.
Yeah, pretty much. I learned to homebrew on a stovetop. I started with a homebrew kit I got for Christmas, brewed it in January, drank it in February. By December, I had a brewery open. So it wasn't the fulfillment of a lifelong dream. It was more of a seizure. But that's sometimes the best things happen that way. You fall in love at first sight, you know. Nothing
were you,
like it.
I mean, were you a beer connoisseur? Were you someone who wanted to do this for?
No. I grew up here drinking Old Style and Old Milwaukee and, you know, and hams with my father-in-law. So no, I wasn't much of a beer fan, you know. It was more of a social ritual than it was something you loved.
Something about that. I mean, the idea of social ritual. When you talk about who likes what beer, why they like the beer, sometimes it's less about the actual flavor in the beer and more about the experience.
That's right. I think when beer lovers open a beer nowadays, there's an expectation of an adventure. They want it to take them someplace. They want the label to be something they might stare at or that somebody else might notice they're drinking and ask them what they're drinking, or just the flavors or somehow linger on your palate or upsetting in one way or another. I mean, just being good or bad, even in craft brewing, leads to apathy, but even being hated requires something special. You know?
So. That's true. That's like any art, right?
That's right. Exactly right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's community around these beers. I mean, yes. I think about Lagunitas, and we're going to talk, I mentioned right before the break, just the idea of you having two different locations, California, right here in Chicago, which came here, and we'll talk about that as well. But it always has been about community and about this idea of who drinks the beer.
Right, right. Well, I have a theory, pet theory about that, that with the rise of social media converging with the rise of craft brewing, that the two really fed each other. And something about social media is I think that people live as primitives now in tribes. You friend this group, you friend that person, you follow this person, that person follows you. And people belong to a number of different tribes, but it's a tribal affiliation that has no commitment except that you choose to be part of that, whether it's Adidas sneakers or Lagunitas beer or off-color beer. I mean,
or WGN radio.
Or WGN radio. That's right. And so people join tribes. I mean, I've been a member of the WGN tribe since I was a little kid watching Orion Samuelson do the October pork bellies. You know, WGN has always been part of my world. And so
I never hear about it when I think of craft beer as tribal like that.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, all you got to do is look on Untappd and look in Beer Advocate and see how people will wrestle with each other and argue over ideas and very nuanced little things. And tribes are held together by shared stories, shared experiences, shared set of values. And tribes work themselves out. And so people can be members of many tribes. So they might be part of the off-color brewing tribe, but those same people could be part of the Lagunitas tribe. And so I just think that community is the most central thing there is in the world of beer. We've had an advisory board at the brewery for years, and on it is actually the chief marketing officer of Facebook. And Gary's just, his office is right next to Mark Zuckerberg's. And he and I have had long conversations about the idea that that beer is actually the original social media. That you would have a public house on a block where the public would come in. Beer was safer to drink than water because of the fermentation process. And in there, people would get a heat on and talk to each other and, you know, settle debts and settle arguments and start new arguments and news of births and deaths. And it was where the news was exchanged. Mm. It's what's Facebook now, but it's a virtual pub.
Right, right.
So and the beer converges with that.
When I think about it, because you grew up in Arlington Heights.
Yes.
Are you aware of the history of beer and brewing here in Chicago, that same concept of community? Because I think about all of the beers that are here, and I think about all the pubs and the taverns and all the things that we've read about that you see leftover signs that might be on taps and other places. I mean, are you aware of that as a brewer, as someone who heads up Lagunitas?
Well, aware of the history of how many – I mean, there have been – I mean, everything from Fox Deluxe. I don't know if you remember, there used to be a Fox Deluxe sign you'd see when you're coming in on the Congress, you know, or coming in on Ohio Street. I mean, and it was painted on the side of a building as a brewery went out of business, Prohibition. But yeah, there's everyone leaves their footprints in this world of beer. And for the time those breweries are around, you know, they're a social resource, you know, and they're a part of the community. And so we want to be that. I mean, from when my very first days when a batch for me was 12 kegs of beer, we were doing donations out of those 12 kegs and never stopped doing. And we have one rule about nonprofit donations, and that is we never say no. There was one time. There was in San Francisco, we got a call from the National Man Boy Love Association, and we just kind of had to decline that one. But we close our tap rooms in Petaluma here, as well as in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Portland, and our place in Seattle. We close them 2 days a week and just give them to nonprofits to use for free as a space. And we provide the beer, provide service, and let them go raise money. Because when people are there doing nonprofit stuff, gosh, they're there because they love it. And if we also love the thing that they love, maybe they'll love us back. Again, tribe building.
I remember the big news when you came to Chicago. I remember the idea that a California craft beer was coming to Chicago, not necessarily leaving behind California, but was coming here. Yeah. What is this Lagunitas? Why come back here? What was it about Chicago that brought your business back here?
Well, it all kind of happened one morning. I was talking to my wife, and she was handling all the logistics and shipping. She was having trouble getting trucks back east when there's vegetables moving because we use the same refrigerated truck since the equipment's not available. And she was talking about how much the trucks cost during those times of years. And I asked her, well, how much do we pay for a truck? And how many trucks a week are going east? And it's pretty quick. I'm on the road, and I'm thinking, well, let's see, like $2,500 a truck times how many trucks it was a week. You know, that's like $150,000 a month. And I stopped, and found a Google mortgage calculator, and I put in that as the payment. And it told me I could borrow $50 million. And I was like, I can build a brewery for that. You know, right. What am I shipping across two deserts and a mountain range or two to get here? And so the next thing was, well, what city to build it in? And I was in a hurry because I either had to add the capacity in California or build it here. So it had to happen fast because we were running out of capacity in Petaluma. And I thought, well, Chicago, it's like this great, incredible, great city. And all these other breweries were flying right over Chicago, going all the way back to North Carolina. And I just couldn't see. And I knew the city, so I figured I know the landscape. Right, I know the people, the culture. It felt good. And I came here, and right away, the vibe was just perfect.
Being in Petaluma, there's a river, there's water. I mean, does the water change? Does the recipe change when you move a brewery?
Fundamentally, yeah. I mean, beers, if it's 6% alcohol, it's 93%
right,
water,
right?
But it's funny, one of the things we realized very quickly is that, we didn't have a plan about this, we discovered it, is that we had been manipulating our water in California, which is really pretty terrible. It has a lot of organic materials in it in the spring when it's runoff from the rains and the snow melt, and then in the summer they start pulling it up out of shallow wells that have a lot of metals in it. It's just terrible. Terrible. And so we've had to fix it and condition it over the years and add minerals to it in a way that made it exactly like the lake right behind us here.
Right.
And so it was like the first batch of beer we made, we threw out just because one of the pipes wasn't clean just right, but the flavors are perfect. So, this is some of the best brewing water anywhere, period.
Is that why we see so many different breweries setting up shop on Lake Michigan?
I think it's why you have breweries up in Milwaukee and, down the Mississippi. It's essentially the same water, when you get down to St. Louis. And so I think, that's why the water's is spectacular for brewing, you know.
Tony McGee's my guest. He's a founder of Lagunitas, the great craft beer brewery, which is both in California and here in Chicago and all over the country now. Lagunitas just recently in the news selling their stake to Heineken. We'll talk more with Tony. Let's take a break for the news. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation because I kind of mentioned at the top about labels. And I want to talk about craft beer, the idea of this sort of explosion of breweries that we've seen, independent and otherwise, and what it means to be a craft brewery in the United States of America. Tony McGee, my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio tonight, Tony McGee. He's the longtime owner, founder of Lagunitas, the craft brewery here in Chicago, which has sold its stake to Heineken, just in the news. Buying in, not selling out, right?
Yes.
We got that. I mentioned craft beer, and I kind of joke around with labels. You famously had a lawsuit against Sierra Nevada over labels. But the idea of labels and putting labels on your beer, and I don't mean what's actually on the glass or what's on the bottle, but this idea that you're a craft brewery or that you're an independent or all the different words that circle around the idea of being a brewer in 2017.
Yeah.
What's your take on it? What, I mean, are you guys a craft brewery?
A good friend of mine, he passed away a few years ago, the founder of Rogue Brewing in Newport, Oregon, Jack Joyce. Jack said it perfectly one time. He goes, "We're not in the beer business. We're in the change business. And we're changing the landscape and changing people's perceptions and expectations, changing retailers' thinking, changing distributors' thinking. And, in fact, we've changed the way the rest of the world thinks about beer. What has happened here in the United States is metastasized now to the rest of the world.
Right.
And so we're in the change business. And when you're in the change business, this is calculus now because you have, you know, you got three variables moving all at once. And so you have rates and you have rates of change. And when you're living in a topology like that, the surface is always moving away from you. And so if you stand in any one spot and you look straight out from where you are and you run to that thing you're looking at, the surface is moving away from you. The curve is leaving you. And so the crazy, most interesting, and also most challenging thing about being around this craft brewing since the 90s, the very first brewery started like in 82 and 83, so we were the end of that first wave, is that we are constantly in flux. We're never the same company, really, from year to year. And so the word craft, I don't know. What does it mean today? It's going to mean something somewhat different tomorrow, and a year from now it will mean something completely different.
By shifting and not being in the same place and being a change agent and all that, is it a challenge to find consistency? Meaning you have great products and you have great beers that come out, the IPAs, and people want it.
Right.
But at a certain point, it's a fickle world in the way that maybe in 3 months' time, they're like, oh, something else, some other shiny object grabbed my attention in the grocery store.
So how do you stay relevant, you know? And you don't stay relevant by fixing your recipe and by refreshing, quote, and your label. You stay relevant by staying in touch with human beings and gluing your business to the people around you and to beer lovers. And sometimes you're perfectly in tune with them and sometimes you're not, but you're always striving to understand not what they're asking you for, but what they're dreaming you'll do next. In craft brewing, we constantly have to invent an iPhone. Mm-hmm. You know, it always has to be that kind of thing. I can't just do a faster flip phone and a hoppier IPA and somehow that's going to be special. It's going to be nice, but it's not special and it's not adventure and it doesn't necessarily capture people's imagination. So, like I said, we're in the change business. So the word craft has morphed and really moved a long way from where it was when, again, the same cat, my brother-in-law, he was working with the Brewers Association. He had suggested that name and it took root.
Because it used to be microbrewery, right?
That's right. That's when we started out, yeah. We were a nano brewery when we started. The word nano didn't exist then, but if a beer for me was 15 gallons, I was pretty much a nano brewery, you know.
As the brand gets bigger, and now you mentioned Heineken as well, and you're talking about European markets or South American markets or other places that they're going to exponentially just triple, quadruple the people who are drinking Lagunitas. Is it harder to keep in touch with that community, that tribe? I mean, is it gets too big for you to be able to keep in touch with what they want?
Well, you do different things, you know. There are brewers out there who specialize in making very exotic, small-scale beers that are very exciting to the people, and they know they're exciting. So we do somewhat different things. You know, we don't do a full sour beer, which is an extremely intensive thing to do. You know, we do the Aunt Sally, which is a differently constructed sour. It's the one we can do at our scale and still hope it's challenging, still hope it engages people, you know. There's so many layers to this industry now. There's, you know, there's just these very, very small guys. There's the mid guys. Mm-hmm. There's the pub-sized guys. There's the 50,000-barrel breweries. You know, and then there's all the way up to us at the million. And then there's still Boston Beer at 6 million barrels.
So. Well, I think about
And now there's Anheuser-Busch and its entire tribe of – they have their own tribe. I think they just bought their ninth brewery.
Well, I mean, I think of that as a microcosm of the city of Chicago. I mean, think of all the breweries that popped up here, successful ones like you and others that are making their name. But then I also think this town is headquarters has Miller's Coors, you know, like
Constellation.
And Constellation. So, you know, this is a town that is very similar to the way America looks at beer.
Yeah. Well, Chicago is a city of tribes, isn't it? I mean, whether there's Lithuanians or Greeks or Polish or, you know, it's Irish. I mean, this is a city of tribes. So, but there's a reason why it's right where it is in the middle of the country.
I don't use that word compete, but is it hard to coexist when you have so many different companies making millions of dollars and trying to make their tribe larger in this town?
You know, it hasn't been difficult. And so it's never felt like competing, you know. I feel like we compete to tell our story with ourselves, to tell our story well. And when we do that, things go well, you know. No, it's not so hard. You know, in any case, craft brewing is I think nationally is 12% of all the beer that gets sold. Now, in San Francisco, I think it's just about half. And Portland, Seattle, it's close to that too. So here in Chicago, I think it's probably in the low teens.
How do you get it to half in Chicago?
Well, it's happening. I mean, it's a generational change, and retailers changing their minds, and distributors really beginning to focus, and it feeds itself, and people then crave adventure, and after a while, you know, just refreshment in a beer isn't really adequate anymore. They want that adventure, and so here it's in those teens, but it's growing like crazy, and it's not done growing, and it'll be half of the business in Chicago too before it slows
down. You mentioned
so when there's that much open field running, you don't compete with each other so much, you know.
You mentioned the idea that it was sort of a hobby when you started this 24 yeah. years ago on your stovetop.
It was a Christmas present.
Yeah. What were you planning to do with your life?
I was selling commercial printing, which is like one of those invisible things that nobody even knows what it means. You know what I mean? If you get a bank card from, you know, Bank of America solicitation in your mailbox, you know, to get a Visa card, back then I might have printed it. That's all, you know. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a musician, you know. So get to play again now, but that was what I'd hoped to do.
Well, I'm thinking then to where you were and thinking now 24 years later, and you're talking about different continents and the expansion of the Christmas present. How does that make you feel? What goes through your mind when you're talking about where you are now as where you were almost 25 years ago?
It's a little dizzying, you know. It is. Something, I mean, especially like in this transition period here where we're really – you know, now I'm starting to talk with the Heineken Operating Company in Brazil about the two craft breweries that they own down there by accident. They didn't even know when they bought this larger brewery, it owned two small ones. It's dizzying to think about, you know, kind of operating on this level. Sometimes I feel like I'm falling over backwards, you know. But again, I'll find my footing, and we're going to – there's a lot of work to do.
And I guess when you're now at the point where you have a lot of work to do – and you have this moment where things have changed for you. Again, this is a business of change. What are the emotions? Are you scared? Are you nervous? I mean, what are the emotions that go with the idea of tripling your business and going down and trying essentially a new job for you?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was a musician, right? And I didn't play for a lot of years. Then I started playing again, and I met up with some friends here in Chicago who were professional players I'd known from college. And I remember the first dozen gigs or so we went on, it's stage fright. I remember that feeling is profound. It's right, and it tells you to run, you know.
Right.
And that's how I feel right now, in all total honesty. You know, but I'm got to lean into the wind here, and because there's enormously cool things to be done. I mean, this is in some ways, not to be pretentious about, but I think it's historic. This transcendence of a craft brewery being able to step onto a global stage. As itself.
Right. It's not, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, the same as some of the acquisitions that made the newspapers, whether it's Goose getting bought by Budweiser or even some of the Miller Coors stuff. This is a different kind of arrangement.
Right. I mean, the Halls, you know, they worked hard and they did the thing and they built the Goose to the place it could be. You know, they were early in the industry, they made it harder, and so they step away, you know. So now it's another company shepherding it forward, you know. We're doing it ourselves. And so the original impetus is still present. The original kind of curiosity is still present in the company. Yeah, if we can do it, it'll be really something.
Do you consider yourself a Chicago company?
It's funny, you know. You know, some people, like, they would ask me, it's like, so is a Chicago, you know, it's a California brewery comes to Chicago. It's like, well, let's see. I left Chicago when I was 27, which meant I was pretty much grown up, right? And it's like, when I went there and I designed the labels, I wrote the recipes, I you know, I designed our collateral, I named the brewery. But I was doing it in California, so I don't know. Is it a Chicago brewery in California in the first place?
Right.
And to be honest with you, it took us a while to kind of get in sync with San Francisco. We weren't like really like understood well early on, and it took us a while to kind of earn our stripes there. And so I think it was just thinking. It's like we're actually more of a Midwestern brand that just happened to get born elsewhere, which is I'm into that. I think it's, you know, kind of mixing cultures, mixing up the tribes.
There you go. Oh, man, this is good. Tony McGee, the longtime owner, founder of Lagunitas. We were talking about the recent sale that Heineken owns 100% of Lagunitas now, but Lagunitas continues and looks to grow globally, global representation. Tony McGee, thanks for being my guest tonight. Thanks for being my guest at the big table, and good luck with the future endeavors of Lagunitas.
I enjoyed your questions. Thank you very much, man.
Whenever I read a promo for the Hometown Voices, I love doing those, by the way. We have always had great ones. Oh, my God. Des Plaines. We went to Antioch, Crystal Lake. I just automatically just want to, yeah, that's my hometown. You hear the commercials they have, the promos they run, and they play that country song. Yeah, that's my hometown. When I hear that, I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
Shazam that one.
I think I'm going to just have ask Duffy to cut that up right there, you singing it, and insert that in for all future promos.
I'm always on a lookout to find an entree, if you will, into modern country music. So when I hear that one over and over, yeah, that's my hometown. I'm like, I'm going to get the old phone and hold it up to WGN Radio, Shazam that, see who sings that. I'm sure the listeners right now, some listeners tell me who sings that.
When Tony McGee was here, I was trying to come up with like some beer songs, maybe to like go in and in and out of the segments. And so if you want to introduce yourself to country music, put in beer in Spotify. Oh my God.
You should have just put, here's to good friends. Tonight is something special. Was it Lowenbrow?
Yeah.
You know, or Strohs is spoken here. When Greg comes in for swap meet tonight, maybe we can talk about how much a Strohs can is worth these days.
They still make Strohs.
Do they make
Strohs? I think so.
I feel like if they made Strohs, I'd ironically drink it. Like, I would be that guy who's like, can I get a Strohs? And then high five my friends while they're drinking their craft beer just to show them how cool I am. My dad had a friend named Stosh. That was his name. And I would always get that confused with Strohs. When I'd see the Strohs commercials in the 80s, I'm like, oh, it's like my dad's friend Stosh. I'm like, no, those are two different words. A little different. And I'd be like, maybe Stosh drinks Strohs.
Mm. Why not?
Why not? All right, coming up, we're going to talk fashion. We were kind of joking around a little bit earlier, and I heard Ro and Anna talking about the romper for men. I'm sure you've seen this story.
Yeah.
It's an amazing story to me because, you know, they raised a lot of money for this company in Chicago, raised a lot of money to bring this fashion to men in Chicago. And it has just really struck a chord, you know. And I think what I'm trying to get at, and I want to talk to Jennifer Warman. She's my guest coming up here. She does Red Soles and Red Wine. She also T&J Designs. She's big in the fashion world here in Chicago. But I really wanted to find out why fashion strikes such a chord. You know, when we see something in a runway or something that might just be a little bit out of the box or might be different, oh, it just becomes the center of mockery in this way that people just think it's the funniest thing or people really have something to say about this issue. And to me, I feel like, you know, frankly, that's, I don't know, sometimes, you know, in 5-10 years, every guy's going to be wearing a romper.
Right. I'm sure at some point jeans were this going, people go nuts.
In 10 years, everybody's going to be wearing a romper, and they're going to be like, yeah. Just like, look who's here. This is good. Look who's in studio. Duff's in studio. Hey, buddy.
Anybody calling about hometown yet?
No. Question, do you know what? Who is it?
Well, I produced it, yeah.
Yeah, right. So, of course.
Remember Uncle Cracker?
Oh, there we go. All right.
Who was part of Kid Rock's crew.
All right.
And like Kid Rock, apparently as they age, they apparently find a little bit more love in country.
Yeah, I'm all right,
rock,
Uncle Cracker.
Hip hop or whatever.
This is like a celebrity sighting.
Yeah.
Chris Duffy, ladies and gentlemen, in studio.
I haven't been here since the new lights are...
Terrible, aren't
These
they?
These are awful. Seriously.
Patty brings lamps in. She brings a whole set of lamps to change it up. I know, I'm sweating.
You know, one time I was in an ER. This is like, you know... Doctors could do surgery in here. Ooh, I don't like. I'm leaving.
Well, good to see you, buddy.
Yeah, good to see you. Uncle Cracker.
Uncle Cracker.
My hometown. Yeah.
My hometown. All right, there you go.
See you.
Thank you, buddy. Wow, all right. What a round of applause for Duff. That's awesome, right? The download, we need to get more of that style, that vibe, where just celebrities walk in the room, you know, have something to say about whatever we're talking about. That would be great. It's almost like a Howard Stern show, you know? Where it's like they'll be talking, oh, look who's here, Donald Trump's here. You know,
yeah, just like the drop in.
Yeah, drop in. The download's drop in.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. Yeah, so we'll talk with Jennifer Warman. Also, there's a big storytelling performance this weekend, Sunday afternoon in Skokie. So we will talk with some of the performers, the storytellers that will be part of that. It's called Israel Many Voices. And it's essentially a show that is about. The homeland, whether it be two stories about stories around, stories about identity, Jewish identity. So we'll talk with some of the storytellers coming up. And, of course, Greg Flamm, the swap meet, 312-981-7200. He is on the show tonight. Of course, it's Wednesday night. We want to evaluate your junk. Hopefully, preferably you're not in a male romper.
I do want to find out about beer cans.
Did he talk about beer cans? Yeah, he'll tell us.
I know
he was on
signs.
2 weeks ago. He had beer cans too, like the old ones with the sort of, you know, the way that the, I don't even know what you call them, the way they would pop.
A flip top,
yeah,
or whatever.
Well, not a flip top, but you pull them off it would separate from the can.
Yeah, and then you hear stories about, you know, like teenagers swallowing them.
Yeah, or slicing your toes at the beach.
Yeah.
So we'll talk. Greg Flamm, the swap meet coming up tonight, 312-981-7200. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll get the news, and then we'll talk fashion. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It is the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up to the 10 o'clock hour, Greg Flamm's going to be here for the swap meet, 312-981-7200. If you got something in the house, memorabilia, collectibles, junk that you want to brag about, man, Wednesday night at 10 is your hour. It's so fun. 312-981-7200. That's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, this week, we heard endless stories about rompers. Yes, the one-piece breezy shirt slash short combo. It's a mainstay in a woman's summer wardrobe, but a new company is raising money to make them for men. And that's really hit a chord. Jeez. Everyone in town and on the internet has something to say about this new fashion idea, and I guess that's what makes fashion so interesting. It's so much more than clothes. It's style. It's trends. It's sometimes it's what's acceptable and what's not. One woman knows all about the trends and fashion. Her name, Jennifer Warman. She's the woman behind the fashion blog Red Souls and Red Wine. She's also the CEO and owner of the fashion brand T&J Designs. She was just in the Mother's Day edition of Splash Magazine, and she's in studio tonight. Jennifer, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so let's talk about this. This story this week, you know, we've been talking about you coming on the air for a while just to talk generically about fashion, but
yes,
it seems like we came at the right time with this romper for men.
Yes.
Why do you think
the romper?
Why do you think this is causing such a stir?
Well, anything viral nowadays seems to cause a stir. And when you're on Kickstarter, it's the best thing ever because so many people hear about it.
Right.
And the more money you raise, the better it is for you to create.
Right.
Yeah, they're making money. The big thing, you know, we were talking about with rompers is women know that you either love or you hate rompers. And I think the funny thing is it's a lot of it is going to the restroom. Like, rompers are a pain. Like, you have to take the entire thing off to go to the restroom. And I think men are so easily, I mean, they're so used to being able to go to the restroom easily, and they would have to take the entire thing off just to go to the restroom.
They would have to fit. They would figure something out, I would assume.
I don't know. I mean, that's really the only choice you have. You have to take it all off.
How often do you see in the fashion world where something gets a rise like this, where something from the runway or an idea or a piece of clothing that is sort of like a gender switch grabs the attention and sort of is I guess ridiculed and mocked and talked negatively about, but at the same time positively?
Yeah,
how often do you see something like
this? I don't even think it's negative. I actually think it's positive. It creates conversations. It makes you laugh. Like, when you see the picture of all the dudes in there rompers, you kind of laugh, and they're in pastel color. So I think it just creates more conversation, and that's what viral things as well as Instagram has done nowadays. I don't necessarily think trends are bad. I think they create a great community.
Do you think this is a trend? Do you think that
I don't think it's a trend. I think it's just a viral thing that people are, you know, I'm not going to see like my husband walking around with a romper or, you know, or some guy going to the football game wearing this. So I definitely see it just, you know, blurbs of people really grabbing onto something, which happens. Like, you know, what was it, like a year ago when they're talking about the dress being different colors and it was a picture.
Oh, right.
I think there's usually one thing that everybody just is kind of goes viral and everybody talks about.
We're talking, you know, as we talk about fashion and we try to get to understand it a little bit more for a lot of people who may not necessarily see themselves as fashion minded because they don't necessarily want to buy the clothing or sort of go at that price point. But talk about fashion and what it really is. It's not really about the clothes, is it?
I love fashion because to me it expresses so much of yourself and what you, I mean, it's the first thing people see when they see you, not only how you look, but how you dress, how you put yourself together. When you go into an interview, that's what they see. So it's a way to express yourself. And I definitely think that there's ways to put together outfits that can make you happier or make you feel different moods or make you feel, you know, depending on where you go, feel beautiful or relaxed or, yeah, there's just different things that you can experiment with clothing.
For us, I mean, I think about the idea that I just mentioned, price point.
Yeah.
And more often than not, we'll see runway shows, you know, whether it's in New York or Milan or Miami or something great. And you think, oh, that, oh, man, I would totally buy it. And then you're like, you look at it, you're like, that's thousands of dollars to purchase that outfit. Are people paying that much money for an outfit?
There is the percentage of people that are paying that high cost. And then,
like, thousands of dollars for a romper.
I mean, look at the number of luxury brands in Chicago and New York. I mean, there are people. It's definitely a smaller number of people. But there are people who will spend that money and also know the quality of craftsmanship and the design that go after it. But now with fast fashion, like, you can find imitations or things that are similar in
fast fashion. What is that?
It's basically, you think of Zara. So if you see something on a runway and is on the floor within 3 months, or Forever 21, I think their cycle's 30 days. You can get something similar basically quickly and inexpensively. Zara is the premier example of that and being able to.
Do they work with designers on that, or are they just ripping it off?
They are imitating it in a nice way. that's how I would call it.
It's a great way to say
it. Yes. They do not work with the designers because the designers, you know, obviously they've put in 9-12 months of work. There are people hand sewing everything, you know, like at Chanel, or, you know, they hand bead everything, and then someone in China or wherever can really imitate it quickly with a machine or somebody who can sew in, you know, not as delicate way. But that is what's going on in the industry, is just people are able to find things so quickly for so much less.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, and you're also in Chicago, and we're here on Michigan Avenue, and you'll see a lot of the high-end boutiques here, whether it be purses or jewelry or clothing.
Yeah.
But I always wonder, what's the future of that market? Because we see every single day there seems to be a story coming out in the business section about Macy's is closing stores or more people are going online to shop. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you think about the future of high-end fashion retail?
I think high-end is doing well. I think that the high-end and the low-end fashion are doing well. It's the middle people that are really suffering, because instead of paying $1,000, you can pay $100. But then it's the $300 to $1,000 mark that's really hard. The designer market will always have its niche people. Think of, like, somebody who loves a Lamborghini or a Porsche. Okay. It's like saying they would disappear. They wouldn't, because people always want those name brands and always love those designs. So no matter what, buying, you know, a different car that's $20,000, this is never going to be the same. So I think that market is similar with clothing, and really some people really appreciate the artwork and the design that go into it. So they will pay, and they have the money so they can pay for it, and they don't want a knockoff.
Jennifer, do you see different generations? When I think of millennials and I think of all the consternation around, we saw this week even questions, a millionaire in Australia saying don't eat avocado toast and maybe you can buy a house. Do the secondary generations or the younger generations coming up, do they have the appetite for high-end fashion? Are they the same thing where they say, oh, I have to have Chanel, I have to go? I mean, are they following in the same sort of footsteps as the generations before them?
I think it all depends on who your parents were and how you grew up. Like, I would say I lived in New York, and that was very similar. If your parents carried nice things, lived in a nice place, like, it just went down the line. I think right now, with the number of successful millennials, it's really changed. I lived in San Francisco, and I was there last year for 4 months in the .com area, and there are you know, people with millions of dollars in their bank, and they dress in jeans and a t-shirt, and they're super laid back, and they work at Facebook or they work at Google.
Right.
And you would never know. And they drive like a Honda, or, you know, they don't live like that. So I think it just really depends on your position and how you see life and, you know, sustainability, or do you want to be more the excess, yeah, like the rich kids of Beverly Hills or something?
Well, I always wonder too, just about as we see more and more, and we've kind of had this conversation when it comes to high-end restaurants or, yeah, or other places where someone comes in a jeans and t-shirt.
Yeah.
You know, the casualizing of our society where there isn't this this line
regimented
that says, yeah, yeah, where it's like you have to wear a college shirt.
You have to wear a jacket,
yeah,
at this restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Is that also playing out in the fashion world where you see more and more people pushing away from the high-end label or the high-end expensive clothes to, mm-hmm, say, I'm fine with this pair of jeans?
I think it's more style now that's pushing more casual, not necessarily designer or non-designer. Like Chicago to me is a very casual city. You know, everybody, you can dress really casually to a really nice restaurant, and there's very few restaurants that are jacket only. And then you'll go to New York where there's, you know, a handful of restaurants or are jacket only, but it really just depends on the lifestyle that you have. Like a lot of jobs now, it's all business casual or even casual. So I feel like it's more style that has gone more casual than a price point.
Jennifer Warman's my guest tonight. She is the woman behind the fashion blog Red Souls and Red Wine. She's also the CEO and owner of the fashion brand T&J Designs here in Chicago. You said you've lived in a lot of different cities, yeah, in your lifetime. Does the fashion world respect Chicago? Does Chicago have a place in the fashion designer's heart?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's why you see all the brand names here. And then the number of entrepreneurial women I know that design and create and sell here is incredible.
Really?
Most of my friends here all own their own business and do some sort of thing in fashion or writing or social media. What's incredible here is that the community is very supportive. There's competition, not as much competition as New York or LA or California in general, but the community here is smaller, so you're tighter and you know each other and people are helping each other out, so it's easier to get noticed.
Is there room to grow? Does Chicago have any sort of desire to compete with a New York or LA when it comes to fashion?
I definitely think so. With e-commerce and just the way things are moving, it's not necessarily where you're located,
yeah,
anymore.
Right.
Like with my business, a lot of people don't even know that we're based out of Seattle as well as Chicago. They think we're from California, and that's just based on the style of our website and how we dress and how we do the photo shoots. So I don't think people really care, because at the end of the day, they're on a website. They don't really look to see where you're from. And as long as, right, they like your goods, you know, that's good.
Can
enough.
You tell? I mean, you've been in this business for a while. Can you tell where a fashion designer is located based on the things you just mentioned, the photo shoots, the way they set their websites up? Is there distinct styles of fashion sort of broken out in the country?
There definitely is between California and, you know, New York. There's a big difference.
What would be the difference?
In New York, they're a little bit more streamlined. A lot of neutrals, grays, blacks, whites, a bit more modern. I think California is a bit more fun, laid back, boho chic. And you do see more of the sort of festival look in California, whereas you wouldn't see that type of site, you know, in New,
right,
York. Yeah.
What about here? What's our thing?
You know what I love about Chicago is it's
male
a blend.
Rompers?
male rompers. It's a blend of it all. I think so many people are from different areas that I kind of see all of it mixed in within Chicago, and that's what's great. Is there? I don't really actually even know what that distinct style is here. Everybody has their own style. I've met a wide variety of people, and there's some people are preppy, some people are boho chic, some people are super casual, some are glam. I've met all extremes. And of course you can meet that in New York and in LA, but they do have a look. Yeah.
For this fashion industry, and I try to pay attention as much as possible, and I feel like it's really hard to get past the headlines about Kanye West or Kim Kardashian. Like, you know, like you never can get to the real. So what do you think are the challenges that are facing the fashion industry as we know it?
I think the biggest challenges right now are for retailers, big boxed brands that are closing down, and the fact that everything is accessible online. And people are very savvy. People are price conscious. People want the best for the least price. And going into a store is not as common as you think. And if you do go into store two, people are pickier about the experience. Whereas, you know, when I was younger, like Black Friday, going to the mall with the big crowds was the experience. And now I find that a lot of people avoid that time because right. it's a bad experience. But when I was growing up, it was a good experience because I met, it was Christmas
so people,
time next.
Right. People are buying these high-end items, $1,000 outfits online?
Yeah. I mean, you look at Net-a-Porter, you look at Bergdorf's, they all have huge online presence. And it really is that niche. They know what they want. They know how to shop. And right now with free shipping, really mm-hmm. going back and forth, and with Amazon, I mean, with the Prime, everything is going online.
All right. So my last question for you would just, what are we going to see on the streets of Chicago this summer? What are you stoked about? What are you obsessed about when it comes to the fashions of the summer here in Chicago?
Yeah, I love the fact that you can wear shorts and like a t-shirt or shorts and like an off-shoulder tops are still very popular, and they were last year as well.
Write this down.
As they were last year as well as the year before. But you can wear really anything, like a flirty dress, or you can wear a crop top. I mean, I don't wear crop tops. I'm a bit too old to be sporting those, but I love just the fact that, you know, the concerts come here and you see the festival looks, and
looks are a thing now, right?
It is a thing. The boho,
like Pitchfork
chic
and
look.
Lollapalooza, yeah. And things like that.
Yeah, it is. It's a great look, and I kind of go more the glam and pretty route, but I love it on other people.
Are you the person that's walking down Michigan Avenue and you see three outfits that are the same and you're like, oh, noted, I'll pay attention to this? Like you can
I do like to notice trends and what's going on, because for me, I sell fast fashion. I sell basically things within 30 days. I want to know what's trending and I want to make sure it's on my site, so I'm always on the lookout as to what's going on and what's trending.
All right, Brompers, that's definitely,
yeah, that's, am I gonna see you in one?
Yeah, no, I'm tomorrow, Friday, I've already picked out. I've got neutral, gray, black.
Not a pink one?
Festival.
Yeah.
And what else did you? Boho chic.
Yeah, boho chic.
I'm picking it up, see?
Yeah.
Jennifer Warman is the woman behind the fashion blog Red Souls and Red Wine. She's also the CEO and owner of the fashion brand T&J Designs. Jennifer, thanks for coming in and getting us updated on the summer fashion trends. And we hope to have you back soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, coming up, two storytellers in studio. Talk about the big show at the Doubletree by Hilton and Skokie, Israel Many Voices. She's coming up here on Sunday. Talk about that, as well as Swap Meet coming up at 10 o'clock. 312-981-7200. Greg Flam will be here at DuPage Picker. We will take your questions and calls about what you think your junk is worth. It's such a simple concept, and yet every night we do this. Every Wednesday night, someone goes, I got this thing. I don't know anything about it. And Greg looks it up, and he goes, you know, it's going for $2,500 on eBay. And it happens all the time. It's amazing to think about all the things you might not even know that you have value that's right underneath your nose, hanging on your wall, the bottom of, you know, right next to your garbage, and maybe in the garage. Behind all the broken tennis rackets. We get broken tennis rackets as well. So that's coming up 10 o'clock. All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN. Thanks, Rob, for that news update. There'll be another one coming up here at 10 o'clock. And after that news update, Greg Flam will be here. We'll do the swap meet, 312-981-7200. Well, this Sunday, the Skokie Doubletree by Hilton turns into a speakeasy. Well, a storytelling speakeasy. The show is called Israel Many Voices, and it's stories from and of the land. It's a performance put on by several local Jewish organizations led by the Spertus Institute. The show will feature Jewish storytellers sharing their experiences with home and identity. Tonight, two performers are here in studio, Debbie Lewis and Michael Simon, two of the storytellers featured. The show on Sunday afternoon at 3:30 at the Doubletree by Hilton, which is the Northlight Theater, if you know that, right next to Old Orchard, right there in that 9599 Skokie Boulevard. Debbie, Michael, thanks for being here. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So let's talk about this show. I mean, doing a storyteller show, and there's plenty of them around town. You can see them everywhere. But talk about the idea of theming it really surrounding identity.
Sure. Well, what's interesting for us is that we are all, I think, amateur storytellers. Most, if not all of us, are doing this for the first time on a stage. So part of this was a the whole thing of taking your identity and turning pieces of it into a story that you're going to share in community. And I think that the idea here was, in the Jewish community, Israel is such a complex and fraught topic, and a lot of times it's put into like an idea that's black and white, but it's very personal for so many people, Jewish and non-Jewish. And here you have a chance with seven different people just sharing really diverse perspectives on Israel through their own stories.
Debbie, why'd you get involved?
Well, I was lucky enough to know a local Jewish storyteller named Susan Stone, who had heard me talk about my history with Israel and my connections, and suggested that I apply. I was excited to be accepted.
For you, for both of you, I mean, to talk about getting up on, it's one thing to have a personal story and to have a connection to Israel, but it's another to get up on stage in front of, you know, hundreds of people to tell that story in an entertaining type way. What do you have to do to take when we're going to talk about what you're going to perform, but what to take your story and ready it for an audience?
Well, we were lucky enough to get to work a couple of times with Scott Whitehair, who is a sort of well-known local storyteller and really great director, and helped us focus on, you know, telling what we already knew. Some of us had fastidiously written it all down, and helped us translate it into something that felt more natural and engaged closer with the audience that we'd be talking to.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting process because there we have like a professor of writing who gives lectures. You know, I run the Jewish Center Hillel at Northwestern, and I've given many talks. I've even given versions of my story in talks from paper, like in a speech.
Yeah.
But to turn it, you know, into a story that we've workshopped our stories. We've, you know, honed it into how we will connect, not just with a concept, but trying, as you said earlier, you know, we're trying to connect personally with each person in that audience. We're not going to maybe get that with every single person, with every story. But that honing process, I mean, I think it's been really fun and interesting for us to do it in partnership with each other and with Scott.
Yeah, I mean, I love the concept, because a show that is going to be about identity and really telling stories around that, I mean, you really do, in a way, I mean, you have to be able to tell that story in a way that's going to connect with the people in the audience. It's almost the best style or platform or discipline for this, because, you know, if you did a speech or a talk, that's a different kind of thing. This really leading with your heart when you're talking about home.
Absolutely. And I think for many of us, these are really emotional conversations that we might be having with this audience. Some of these stories are very sweet and heartwarming. Some of them are funny, but all of them come from a really deep personal place. And I think the sort of ad-libbed version of it, even though we've spent some time thinking about it, really helps make that a one moment and in the moment kind of experience for everyone.
The show on Sunday afternoon is called Israel: Many Voices, Stories from and of the Land. You know, as we mentioned, let's talk about the stories. I mean, both of you have personal stories or points of view on Israel and what it means to you. Why don't we start with Michael? What's your story going to be? Tell us a little bit about your story and what the premise is.
Sure. Well, so when I was 30 years old, or actually 29, fact checking, right?
right off the bat.
When I was 29, I went to Israel for the first time. So I was I work with college age students, and I work with them as they're grappling with their identity. And Israel had been in the mix for me. I grew up in a connected Jewish family, but it had never been. And going to Israel when I was almost 30, I thought I was going for 2 weeks to check it off the list, and then I can go back to the rest of my like secular life. And I worked in community development. I wasn't a Jewish professional, you know, in quotes. And there's a whole big story of how over the past, I guess it's now 16, 17 years, my entire life shifted to becoming a Jewish professional after 2 weeks that ended up then being a year, which became 2 years in Israel.
Really?
And so I,
you know, I'll talk in the in my story, and I don't want to give, you know, we're
such a good story, such a good entertainer, right?
We're not giving the stories away here, but you know, but I the year I lived in Israel that I will be telling my story around was 2001, 2002, which was the height of the Second Intifada. And I went there for what I thought was a year, became 2 years. And I fell in love with three things. And I can say that here. I fell in love with the land of Israel. I fell in love with Jewish learning, which I had never done in a significant way as a child, teen, or as an adult mm-hmm. until then. And I fell in love with a woman. And so my story that I'll be telling is that finding of love, losing love and finding love again.
You know, it's such it's I hear it all the time. I mean, from friends and people who've gone to Israel for the first time, and they, especially Jewish people, when they go back and they have cathartic and religious experiences. I mean, to be in the homeland, maybe for the first time, maybe it wasn't their intention. They were going for a vacation, like you said, check it off the list. I mean, is it the same concept in your story, the idea that something changed in your life by just being in the Holy Land?
Yeah, I think, but I would hedge a little bit away from the religious and the Holy Land part of it. It happened to be for me that there was a context of Jewish learning going on in that, and that my own story had observance of religion that was part of it. But it's that core question of identity that I think really, for me, it was less about a connection to the Jewish religion or yeah. God, but it was of this like concept that our people has had some connection. And, you know, it's a very complex, fraught topic, but there's a connection over generations. And I hadn't tapped into that before. And so to be able to tap in and begin to see the richness of what that can mean to tap into that aspect yeah. of my identity, I think that probably is true for Debbie too, right?
Yeah, well, I had been to Israel several times and have been, but my story actually takes place for me entirely here in the United States. And it's interesting that Michael talked about how, you know, it being in Israel, and you said sometimes becomes the gateway into being right. more Jewish. But my story is more about my best friend who moved to Israel permanently with her husband about 15 years ago. And she is secular, atheist, but Jewish in maybe in quotes. And so our relationship takes place, I would say, about 95% over instant messenger on Facebook. I think for me, I feel very connected in a religious and spiritual way to the land. I'm not sure she does. It's a really interesting conversation.
Well, I mean, for both of the stories that you're going to tell, I mean, there is that contrast or that complexity when it comes to, yeah, like even the way I even sort of asked the question. I mean, I kind of said Holy Land or just sort of automatically sort of went to the religion. And there's so much more about the Jewish identity that's beyond just a religion or worshiping a God. It has to do with identity. It has to do with culture. And it has to do with sort of, I would say, connecting with the past.
Yeah, I would agree. That's my experience.
Beyond God,
of it.
Beyond all that stuff.
Oh yeah, for me, that's my experience of being there. I feel a sense of home, even though I've never lived there, and neither has anyone in my immediate family. But the feeling of being there is a feeling of settling in, for me. And I think it is the same for my friend who I'll be telling stories about, but not in any religious way, which is fascinating to me. She's a totally secular Jew living in a religious land, and I'm a somewhat more spiritual Jew living in an entirely secular world.
That's a good contrast.
Yeah, when I used to, a part of my story I won't tell, but I'll share with you here, is that I used to joke that at the time I went, it was right at the height of the X-Files, like the first round of the X-Files, you know, the good one, the original one. And there was this whole trope in that, ongoing trope of people who had these like chips or something, and it was an alien, was a government, but they would get switched on, and then the people would have like they would have a different way. And I joked that, you know, something got switched on in me that had lay dormant my entire life. And, you know, I think what's interesting for me is to be telling the story now, not 15 years ago, when it was a lot of, you know, very emotional and powerful and connected with one version of it. Because like you were saying earlier, it's so complex. You know, I work in the Jewish community where I'm helping to hold a vast diversity of perspectives on Israel. And that's just within the Jewish community. And then I have on a campus where Palestine, Israel is, mm-hmm. you know, a pretty fraught topic. And so my experience with Israel is mostly within Israel with Israeli Jews, but I've tried and begun educating myself about what it means for Palestinians to be living in the land and what their narrative is. And I think one of the interesting things, not to get political on this, is that storytelling, I mean, really is at the core of what it means for peoples to have narratives. I mean, narratives are made up of just mass numbers of, you know, stories coming together.
I think Americans and non-Jewish Americans, you know, it's always interesting to me because Israel will play out in two ways, political or religious. Mm-hmm. And there's not as much played to the social part of it. When I think of Israel, you know, it's a Western country. I mean, in the Middle East, it really is. I mean, it has people don't think, you know, if you really, I mean, it can be as posh as New York City and it can be as rural as Kansas. If you want, you know, it has that kind of diversity to it. Yeah. Do you think that the experience of Israel for non-Jewish Americans is too dumbed down, that it's too the idea that all we hear about is in headlines about which politicians support or don't support the political causes, or it gets wrapped up in religion?
I think that's true, but I think that's probably true for lots of places in the world that, you know, only make the headlines when something exciting happens in politics, right, or war. There are so many really fun things about Israel that have nothing to do with either of those things. And I mean, we could just talk about food for an hour. It's a really fun place to be, no matter sort of what your faith background is or even what your politics are. It's a neat place to visit.
And I think also that, and that's very true of, you know, you could say any place in the world, especially yeah. places of conflict. But what, you know, there are people living within that land and place, and they have their day-to-day lives. And their day-to-day lives, you know, are connected with this broader, you know, politics and religion, but they're also about, you know, going to take their kids to school and what it, you know, and worrying, you know, at the end of the day, they are also building their own stories. And so the interesting thing for us, I think, is why, you know, why as Jews do we, if we're Jewish, do we have potentially a connection to Israel, even if that connection is one that is not a tight one.
Yeah.
And I think for non-Jews, I mean, it is fascinating in our country that it becomes such a, you know, an outsized part of the conversation. And I think it has a little bit to do with what you're saying in terms of a Western, you know, country or Western looking and feeling country inside of the Middle East.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of similar like values that were kind of woven into the building up of the country. And then also that it's in conflict. And so being in conflict drives news.
As both of you being part of the Jewish community here in the area, in Chicago area, do you see a desire from Chicagoans, Jewish Chicagoans, to go to Israel? Overwhelmed. Is it sort of like a bucket list kind of thing where they're like, I have to do it at one point in my life? Because I think a lot of people maybe don't have those generational connections anymore. As more and more generations are here in the United States and don't necessarily have relatives back in Israel, talk about that complexity of whether or not they truly feel like they need to go back.
I do think that it's for the generation older than mine and my parents who are in their 70s, that was definitely a bucket list item. And for mine, probably. And for younger than me, I think Michael's probably better equipped to answer that question. I will say that there's no doubt in my mind that I'll send my children on youth trips to Israel.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting because it is easier than ever, you know, ever in history to travel, you know, thousands of miles, you know, anywhere in the world. And so it's easier, you know, programs in the Jewish community like Birthright have, you're familiar with Birthright, which sends 18 to 26 year olds on a, you know, basically a free trip to Israel from the Jewish community. What I've found is that students are not all just signing up and saying, hey, you know, I'm supposed to go there. I think the politics has become complicated and makes it not always just this obvious like I'm going,
yeah.
But also that the there is a sense of, you know, well, I could go there. I mean, it's kind of an amazing thing. I could kind of go there any time, so I don't have to go right now. I think I also have an interesting window because we're both involved in the, obviously involved enough that we sign on to a program that's being sponsored by Jewish organizations. And there's lots and lots of, I think, Jewish people who are not connected. And I see that on the campus in terms of the students that I know and several hundred who will go over the course of their time to Israel from Northwestern. But there's also those who, for whatever reason, at least right now, it isn't part of what, and traveling there isn't part of what is particularly meaningful to them.
Well, the stories will be on display, the contrasts, the complexities, identity, culture, and home. Israel, many voices, stories from and of the land. It's a performance of stories that is going to be featured on Sunday afternoon at the Skokie Doubletree by Hilton at 9599 Skokie Boulevard in Skokie. Again, 3:30 in the afternoon. Debbie Lewis and Michael Simon will be two of the performers of the seven. You said there's seven performers on Sunday afternoon, and they were my guests tonight. Debbie, Michael, thanks so much for being here on The Download. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's hot in the studio tonight, man. I layered. That's my problem. I've got a suit coat on tonight. And you would think, I mean, the Tribune Tower, we love this building. We're not going to be in here for much longer, less than a year as we move out. But, I mean, it's a historic landmark building, right? But the problem is that not unlike some of the great historic buildings on Michigan Avenue, it takes a while for them to adjust to the elements.
Yeah.
So when a heat wave comes on, or we had this problem in the winter, too, where it's like a cold wave. Do you call it a cold wave? What do you call it?
Cold front.
It takes a while for them to catch up. So I feel like right now I'm layering. I got the collared shirt on, a little sport coat. Too much.
Good thing those the rompers breathe, yeah, so you'll be good to go tomorrow.
I should have definitely flowed. A flowing romper would do well for me right now. Yeah.
It's time for swap meet. Oh yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Or it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Hey, that's me.
Hey, all right, it's time for the Swap Meet here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, this is going to be exciting. 312-981-7200. We are ready to evaluate your junk, as we say every Wednesday here. Good to see you, Greg.
Good to see you, Justin. Thanks.
So just before we start up here, I just want to say that we are paying attention to the tornado warning that's in effect up in the northern Illinois area. Mm-hmm. We'll pay close attention to that, keep you updated on anything as we do the swap meet tonight. But
sure.
Right now, thunderstorm and tornado warnings in the northern part of the state. So we'll pay attention to that here. Rob Martyr's all over it.
Yep.
So we'll see what happens. All right. So as we do every night when we do the swap meet, Greg, you give us an idea of what you've collected over the last week since we saw you last. Good weekend? It was a strong Mother's Day weekend?
Yeah, it was great. Great weather. Great weather to pick and to sell up in Rosemont. And I found some stuff that I normally don't find.
The pickers they're all celebrating mom, and you just slide right in.
I was really surprised how many people were there. I mean, it was like any other Sunday there at Rosemont, and I thought it'd be a little less, but no, it was steady all day.
All right, so let's talk about what you got. You'll start us off tonight, and again, 312-981-7200. You can text or call if you have some stuff you want evaluated tonight. What do you got, Greg?
Okay, so I found a Lux 1950 Lux Cadillac in the box, which is kind of cool.
A toy? What is
it? It's a toy car. I'm assuming it was made like in the 60s, maybe 70s. You know, pretty simple, but they're about $20, $30. But my first one I found in a box anyway. But the more important thing I found was a...
lugging this thing all the way
I'm loving it. I don't even know if I could sell it, but it is a Pink Panther black velvet paint. I'm just like... I love it. I'm like, if you're not into kitsch, as a seller, you're losing money. And if you're not into it as a person, you're just not having fun.
So it's a velvet painting.
Yeah, it's a black velvet.
Of the Pink Panther.
And the Pink Panther is painted on it.
Yeah, it is velvet. That's crazy.
It is.
So they paint on the velvet.
And, you know, everyone knows like the big joke is like the Elvis, you know, velvet painting. Right, it's like the big joke. But some of the like nudes and stuff like that can go in the 300-400 range.
What is something? What is the Pink Panther?
I'm thinking it's probably in the $75 range somewhere in there.
But you just like it.
I do. It's just because you don't get a chance to really buy them. They're usually all gone by the time.
Are you thinking of removing the dogs playing poker from the living room wall?
I'm thinking about it. Yeah, that and my Mike Ditka flipping the bird poster might have to move over for a while.
You can't. So. Yeah, that's maybe take that down till bear season.
Right.
Back
yeah,
up
I can.
Or something
yeah,
like
I can.
That, right.
Yeah.
It's a velvet Pink Panther painting.
Yeah, I love it.
All right. I remember there was a, in my wife's family's basement, one I think it was like an uncle, they had a picture of the bridge, right? It was like a painting of a bridge.
Okay.
And the lights were in the painting.
Oh, yeah.
So they would light up like where the lights were on the Golden Gate Bridge or whatever like that.
Yeah, but they did that. The same thing with, what's that bar or diner where it's like James Dean and other stars are sitting around that diner. That lights up as well. Yeah, those are great. And then that kind of lends itself to the barware again, where you got the waterfall, you know, and that's backlit or it looks like it's moving.
Because this right here, when I see this velvet painting,
yep.
I think basement. I think you might be setting something up.
Yeah, you
I
know, it's good barware. It's very popular with tiki bars now are doing the velvet thing because they incorporate a lot of kish, you know, with the tiki bar scene.
I think what you do is when we get out of here, we go to Logan Square, to hipster bars, Logan Square, and we walk around and just walk in like, you interested in this?
Right.
17,000.
Yeah, best
offer. See what we can get. Or best offer.
Right. I'm all for it.
All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's Swap Meet Greg Flam at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter. All right. Let's see what we got here. 773 starts us off with a 1983 Sony 13-inch color Trinitron TV.
Oh yeah, the Trinitrons.
What's that? What is a Trinitron?
That was the model. I guess it was based on a technology back in what did that be? The early 80s, I think, or he said 83. Yeah. So that was kind of what they called their line of TVs in that day.
That's the, there was like some
Trinitron. Yeah, and they made
specific
probably
technology to a 1983 13-inch color TV.
Yeah, and they would make five different model numbers, but they were like Trinitron, such and such, you know. But yeah, I'm looking up now, and I have seen those quite often because they're bigger. So a lot of people don't really want the bigger TVs.
Like
these
they're
days.
Big in the back.
Yeah,
baby.
Yeah,
got
they're
back
just
kind
big.
Of thing.
Yeah, I mean they made them in the full blown wood consoles or kind of a entertainment center top type thing.
I would say that the television industry, television retail industry, made a huge mistake by going away from the huge TV in the back. Right, they don't recognize it. We all want that, right? I mean, all the people in Michigan. You want those TVs with the big back. That the bigger the back, the more you brag about it, right? You're like, hey, take a look at how big the back of my TV is.
Right, and you also then get the hospital bill or chiropractor bill for it too, right?
Just trying to move that thing. How many of those have dropped? You're trying to move those up a stair, two flights.
Yeah, I mean, and they're not going for too much. I think the highest one I see here is $250, but they have gone as low as
$250 like, for a 13-inch color TV.
Yeah, I'm trying to see.
I don't understand the allure of that. Is it just because it's some sort of retro?
Yeah, it's got to be a retro thing, and the technology from then was kind of top for the day. And but they've gone as low as $18. I mean, it's they're all over the place. So.
Hmm.
But yeah,
well, that's what I would pay. I'd pay $18. A 13-inch TV ain't doing it for me.
But here's where the older TVs come in handy. If you're a gamer and you have the first Nintendo with the Duck Hunt game, they need the older TVs for that Duck Hunt gun to work. They don't work on the new flat screens. So that's something.
Like if I had an old Atari, I would assume that the hookups to the back of the TV probably don't work either because it's the old school, like, like when you're trying to hotwire a car.
Right.
Same kind of thing. Like you just put metal to metal.
Yeah, you had to have that metal little slider adapter thing. And I tend to pick those up whenever I see them too because people need those if they're hooking up to an old TV. So, but yeah, you need the old TVs to use like the zapper gun on Atari or Nintendo's.
The little things we learn on the Swap Meet. 312-981-7200. If you've got a question or you want some advice or you have something you want to brag about tonight, this is the show for you. Greg Flam at DuPage Picker in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. It's Swap Meet.
Oh,
It's a swap meet here on the download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Greg Flamm in studio, at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter. This is a segment in which we evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk. If you want to find out what something's worth, or you just want to call in and brag about it. That's my favorite part.
That is the most fun.
Of the swap meet. It's been like, guess what I got? And I ain't giving it to you.
Yep. We'll be talking about that phone book from Chess Records forever. Found
that
it in the garbage.
That was a dumpster dive.
It was a dumpster, yeah. I don't even think he dove in it. I think it just was thrown out the window of the place.
So hit him right in the head.
And yeah, I found it.
312-981-7200. You know, as we were talking about the just the idea of the TV and this segment in general, are people getting, when you go to estate sales and every, you know, you go to estate sales, garage sales, whatever it is of a weekend, they're going to start seeing that here in May, especially right after the moving day, May 1st, people
right.
moving stuff. Are people getting savvier? I mean, are they
definitely,
understanding, I'm going to go to eBay before I put this out? I mean, are you seeing a different...
Definitely at estate sales, people are smarter shoppers. Flea markets, yeah. Garage sales, not so much. But with technology now, what's great is anything with a barcode, you can pull up an eBay or Amazon app and scan it. And you can tell right there what they're going for, like within a matter of a few seconds. So that's great if it has a barcode. Now, if it's older stuff, you have to, you know, type in the thing, but you could still type
but
in the title.
Still, like, that's a whole step that we never had to do when we had a garage sale, was to go in online and see what its value is, because it can appreciate.
Yeah, a learning moment for me was walking into a room at a house estate sale, and three stacks of puzzles, like brand new, still sealed, never used, and a guy just sitting Indian style scanning all these puzzles. And then I realized, hey, there are puzzles that are worth money, and I should probably get to know some of those, because I, you know, how many times have we walked across puzzles at a garage sale or something? You know, so there are some that are worth, you know, quite a bit.
Yeah,
that was
what kind of a bargaining goes on at these things. I always wonder, because I just remember we had a garage sale when we moved. When we were younger, and my parents had a bunch of like old dishes that mm-hmm. were never used, you know, a stack of 10 dishes or whatever, and it was like $3 or something. And I remember like somebody came up and was like, I'll give you a quarter for it.
Yeah, you're going to get those people
like,
who want everything
on, you can't
for a
even
quarter.
Like a $3, you
right,
know?
Right, right. There's that. Yeah, I, you know, I tend to go a little bit higher because I kind of already build in that barter or that haggle, you know, that they're going to want it for less. But yeah, garage sales, you're going to get that quarter a lot. Flea markets, they tend to know, okay, you're not going to get it for a quarter most times. But you're absolutely right. Garage sales, you will see that.
Is this the right time right now, May, where you start to see garage sales? Like if I were going to go.
Yeah, they've been happening. Weekend, yeah? And they'll go as late as November if the weather's above 45. I mean, I've seen them like just roll up the garage door and just have it inside their garage, even if it's below 40. You know, as long as the sun's out, it's not too rainy. They've been going on, but definitely, yeah, we are in the thick of it now.
Is there like I would think with the internet and the advent of boards, forums, things mm-hmm. like that, is there a place that you go to that people put up on online? Hey, I'm having a garage sale, or is it still the old fashioned? Let's drive around the block.
That is what they call freestyle when you're driving around looking for it. But there are two great apps for estate sales. There's estatesales.net, and it's awesome. You just put in your zip code, you put how many mile radius you're willing to drive around your house. What's great there is they put the pictures of what is going to be at the sale for the most part, everything. And then for garage sales, there's a app. And it's free app, gsailor.com. So it's G-S-A-L-R. So they leave out some letters.
Okay.
But gsailor.com, and there's that's like a GPS thing. I mean, you just it will show a pin where you're at, and it'll be a red flag where there's garage sales. And on a Saturday, Sunday, that thing is just loaded, you know. And
I'm just amazed at the work that has to go into promoting a garage sale and being ready for garage sale. When I mean, it was essentially get the old yellow bins out, put everything you can in there.
Yeah, and what's great about that app is they pull from Craigslist. So if you just put it on Craigslist, a lot of these apps are going to pull right from there. So you don't have to list it 10 times on different apps. So
are you
helps.
A Craigslist? Do you go buy stuff on Craigslist?
Not so much. Like, I mean, because I tend to be more garage sale, estate sales, flea market guy. So I don't really do too many one-on-one transactions on Craigslist unless it's something really rare that I have to have or I know that I can flip for a good amount of money.
All right, 708 says, okay, ask Greg what a Kyosho, K-Y-O-S-H-O, Land Jump Nitro RC car is, remote control car.
Okay.
In mint condition, still runs. Wow. I've had it since 1987. That's great year for remote control
that
cars.
That was a vintage year.
That's a vintage year.
Okay, well, first off, remote control cars, people are spending hundreds of dollars just for the outer body because that's the thing that gets smashed when you're actually playing the car. And the rule of thumb is if that body is bigger than a page and a half, you know, like a long landscape page and a half, you should get that and resell it because people are just paying crazy money. I'm not finding that one.
It's a Kyosha Land Jump Nitro remote control car in mint condition.
Yeah.
Still runs, 1987. I always find myself with those cars. You have to ask the question like, A, how quick does the batteries go?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, people are always fixing those up. And again, like I said, they smash it. But I do have some here that are coming up. And the highest seemed to go for, well, lately about $140 for like the whole car with the remote control. But like I said, if it's bigger than, say, 14, 15 inches long, those are the higher price ones you want to look for.
312-981-7200. Let's go to Jeff. Jeff, welcome to the Swap Meet. What do you want to brag about, Jeff?
Well, I've got some Fleer basketball cards
from
1986-87.
Okay, classic. That would be Michael Jordan.
Okay.
An early Jordan, a Joe Dumars, possibly a Larry Bird, James Worthy. I'm just throwing out basketball players at this point, Jeff.
Magic Johnson. Yeah.
Magic Johnson.
Yeah, no, it's got all the greats in there.
Maybe like a Robert English. I don't know if he was playing at that time.
Yeah.
JoJo English. All right, what do you got for sets of NBA cards? I don't think of NBA cards when I think of collector's items. But I guess they are, right?
Yeah, my brothers and I were young. We used to just go to the card shop, buy boxes of NBA trading cards. Back in the day, we had season tickets to the Bulls.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it was, you know, big thing to follow basketball
Well, again, it's one of those things, condition is everything. And again, individual cards have gone over $2,000, it looks like, for the the hologram type ones. I'm looking up complete sets. So far, I don't have much. But again, they can be as low as a dollar for individual. And sets are looking like, let's see, not really finding too many sets. Mostly, individual or 12 cards.
That's interesting.
Yeah, no, they're all in great condition. Any idea where you'd go about getting them graded?
There's, I think, a company called PSA, if you Google them, or just Google, trading card grading company. I think they charge $14 to $20 per card to get it graded.
Oof.
Yeah, so you really kind of do some research first, and then if you think you got something good, then have it sent in to be graded, and they'll seal it in the plastic and send it back to you with the grading and all that. And then I think after, if you send in the one card, if you send in five more cards, then it goes down to like $8 per card, I think.
Hmm. There you go. Thanks, Jeff.
I appreciate the info, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Listening to you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Listening. All right. 312-981-7200. We got some text coming in. We got some Jim Beam decanters.
Okay.
I've got a Telefunken Opus Hi-Fi wooden case German table radio.
Wow.
815's back with the Ted Nugent's drummer. The drumstick that was signed by the bass player.
The drumstick that
went back. Classic.
Yep.
And John is on the line as well, and a few others. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. We'll get right back to the second half of the Swap Meet right after Rob's news. It's the Download Swap Meet, 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, thanks, Rob. Some nasty weather heading through the area here. It's a Download 720 WGN. We're playing Swap Meet tonight, but before we do that, let's just update what we have here. As you've been hearing from Rob Martier and 720 WGN, as well as our sister station WGN TV 9, some severe weather coming through the area. Pay attention here. This is really for northern part of the state, Rockford area, also into Wisconsin. Right now it's just east of Janesville, sort of a really nasty front that is moving towards the lake. So right now, next in its path, you see just north of Elgin, Wisconsin. So I would say Lake Geneva, Racine, Paddock Lake, that area. Here comes some storms that way. Also, just from Facebook, because I grew up in that area. I have friends who say they're on the Boone-McHenry County line. tornado warning sirens going off. So there's some serious weather that is triggering some warnings here in the northern part of the state. 312-981-7200. If you have something to report, let us know. You can text us. You can call in. You can give us a little bit more information about the severe weather. Now, again, it's severe weather, as I've said. It's a tornado warning. This storm that is going through right now, what that means is it has a potential to develop tornado. A tornado watch is something less severe, but tornado warning says there are either sightings of a tornado or there are weather elements that would be able to form a tornado. And so the tornado warning right now in McHenry County, as well as on the in southeastern Wisconsin, is a tornado warning. So they are worried about this front that's coming through being able to actually have tornadoes on the ground. So we need to pay attention to that. Obviously, the wind tonight, the velocity of the wind not helping. It's a very windy night here in the Chicago area. Of course, as we know, when we have this sort of abnormal heat or abnormal cold and it mixes with a front that's coming in, that could be trouble. So we pay very close attention to this. Of course, once again, tornado warnings for McHenry County, the northern part of the state, also southeastern Wisconsin. And we're paying close attention to the warnings that are coming in from those areas. Again, warnings. No tornadoes have been sighted on the ground. And if you do have any sightings or you want to give us any information, you can. 312-981-7200. But again, severe warning for tornadoes and thunderstorms. But tornadoes are most important until, I think it's till 10:20. I think we said 10:45. So five more minutes, and they may adjust that. They do that all the time from the weather services. But the idea right now, a tornado warning in McHenry County. So we will pay close attention to that and keep you up to date as reports come in from McHenry County and southeastern Wisconsin. And why don't we do this? Why don't we take a break, and then we'll come back, and we'll do the swap meet, and we'll continue with Greg. He's in studio standing by. John, I got some people on the line as well. But why don't we do our break just so we can reconvene and see what we have here as the weather comes through the area. Stay with us. Welcome back here to 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're playing a swap meet tonight, but of course, severe weather is getting in the way tonight. A pretty bad night in the Chicago area, and we just want to take a second to talk about the severe weather. Let's go to Rob Martier, who's standing by. Rob?
Yeah, Justin, right now the National Weather Service issuing a thunderstorm warning for Kendall, LaSalle, DeKalb, Kane, and McHenry counties until about 11:30 tonight. Again, this is a thunderstorm warning for Kendall, LaSalle, DeKalb, Kane, and McHenry counties in effect until 11:30 tonight.
And that's a thunderstorm warning.
That is a thunderstorm warning, correct.
And so does the tornado warning still in effect, or does that kind of... You know,
that one was scheduled to fizzle out at about 10:45, but I haven't gotten a cancellation yet from the National Weather Service. So just assume that, and let me get into that
still
for you
going,
here,
right.
That it's still for
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say McHenry and Boone counties, that was in effect until 10:45, but it hasn't been canceled as of yet. So if you're in McHenry and Boone counties, there is a tornado warning in that area.
All right, so we've got a tornado warning that is in the northern part of the state of Illinois, also southeastern Wisconsin. Walworth County.
Correct.
And then we've got a thunderstorm warning, which is in Kendall County, LaSalle, DeKalb, Kane, McHenry.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be because the front is moving closer to the lake. So we're getting closer and closer. So it's you're going to get Joliet, Chicago, Racine's this is a big storm front that's coming.
Yeah, this one, and what's interesting about this one is that it's a very thin band. It's stretching from Peoria right now, and it's a kind of on a northeast angle. So from Peoria all the way now to the east side of Rockford on into the Wisconsin area, and it's just outside Milwaukee right now. So that's kind of the angle that it's on.
Yeah, and you're right. There's a very thin, as you know, Tom Skilling's on right now live on GN9 as well, but the it's a thin storm. It's not one that is a tremendous storm front that's coming through the area. It's one band of nasty weather that's passing quickly through the area, and I'm sure the wind helps with that.
Yeah, so if you're in Shanahan, Yorkville, Aurora, Algonquin, McHenry, those areas, brace yourselves because it could be to you within about a half an hour to an hour.
All right. Rob Martier, thank you, buddy.
You bet.
312-981-7200. We will pay attention to that severe weather. Of course, the severe weather warnings, both for thunderstorms and tornadoes. The tornado's supposed to fizzle out at 10:45, and I see that the TV stations are changing their graphics from tornado warning to severe weather warning. So maybe the tornado warning is sort of coming to a point where it's expiring. 312-981-7200, the number. Greg Flamm still in studio, being a good. You're just a good guest in the way that you right. this is a swap meet. But of course, we get some severe weather, and you know that we got to take a little bit of a back seat.
Right, no problem. Life happens.
All right, so let's do this. Let's continue. We'll talk a little bit about swap meet. We got some people on the line. We'll get to it, but we'll also pay very close attention to those warnings. Right now, like we said, most of the area just west of the city of Chicago. We're talking about Kane, Lake, Kendall, McHenry. They're all severe weather coming through, thunderstorm warnings in effect. Also, Walworth County, southeastern Wisconsin. The tornado warning looks to be at a point, and I don't have the specifics because we haven't seen it actually by the National Weather Service say it's not a warning anymore. But we're getting close because the television stations have turned to a more severe weather warning as opposed to tornadoes. So we'll pay attention to thunderstorms, which can produce not only heavy winds, rain, but golf-sized hail as well.
Yep.
Nice little Wednesday night for us here in the Chicago area. All right, Greg, let's go to the phones. Let's go to John. John, thanks for holding on. John, what do you got? What do you want to brag about?
Well, I've got a bit of unusual sports memorabilia that I was wondering if it had any value.
Okay.
When I was a kid back in the early 60s, I was pretty much a Wrigley Field rat. I'd get there in the morning and stay there well after the game, and it was back in the days when a kid's ticket cost 60 cents.
Wow.
Anyway, when the game was over, I'd stand under the WGN broadcast booth and holler up to Jack Brickhouse to ask him to throw me down the press notes from that particular day's game. So sure enough, you know, he would always oblige me, roll up the notes, throw them down to me, and I hung on to them, and I saved them all through the years. And, they're copies of the press notes that were distributed by the PR department on legal-sized sheets of paper. It was back in Ernie Banks, Ron Sano, Billy Williams days.
Right.
And, you know, it was all typewritten, all the stats, and all the anecdotes that Jack could use during the game, and as he read the anecdote, he would exit off or put a circle around it so that he'd read it.
Wow, that's great, John. That's a good one. That's a brag. That's
right.
A brag
it's got
moment,
a brag definitely. Of the memory there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great memories.
Yeah, I mean, autograph. I've seen some just like scribbled autographs on like a cocktail napkin go for $12 by Brickhouse, but oddly, there's a bunch of other items. There's a clock that I guess he owned going for $2,000 right now. A bobblehead is $20. A signed ball is $52.
What do you do
him,
with items that are of personal effect or only important to that game? What do you do, like a scorecard or things that weren't sold necessarily?
Yeah, that tends to fall under the memory thing or a brag if it's a press clipping. I mean, it's, I guess if it has the WGN logo, like for broadcasting the game, that, you know, could be
something
in the $100, $200 range. Maybe.
Thanks, John.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
You know, it's interesting too, because we had Scott Simon, who wrote the book, Love Story, My Cubs, we had the book on, he was talking about Jack Brickhouse being his godfather.
Wow.
And was amazing stories about, how Jack Brickhouse would go to the lounge. I forgot the name of the lounge. It's just on the tip of my tongue. Something like Poodle or Pink or something that was just for the press people at Wrigley after the games, and that's where he'd be. That's where they'd all go, and they'd just drink until they had to get kicked out of Wrigley Field.
Yeah.
You don't think about that.
Yeah, I know. I was lucky enough to go to a stadium club back in the day.
Right. It's a little different than stadium
club.
Right,
a little different.
All right. Let's keep going. 312-981-7200. My mom, this is 708, says my mom's got three Jim Beam decanters. Two are 1930s touring car models and a 1940s style phone, all from the 70s. Hmm.
Yeah, the cars are worth quite a bit more. The phone looks like it's going $20 to $40. The cars are as high as $250. The one that's kind of cool, though, is there's like a genie bottle, like a lamp, and that one is going for like $400, $500. So,
but okay, there you go.
Well, they made all different, you know, obviously cars. And, right. Yeah, different decanters. Same thing with the Avon
and
stuff.
Oh, yeah, and 708 wants to let us know that they are empty, by the way. Decanters.
Right. Yeah, because you cannot sell. Okay.
Yeah. 312 says, I have a Telefunken Opus Hi-Fi wooden case German table radio.
Yeah, that's great.
What's it worth?
Yeah, they're between $150 and $450.
What?
Yeah, depending condition and so forth.
That's a good one.
It is.
There's your winner tonight.
Yep.
Joy, who's a regular listener, has sent along some really interesting ornate, I guess you'd call them almost like bowls or almost like
ornate.
Would they have like lids on them? Mm-hmm. She sent a bunch of pictures. I don't know what they're worth, but they're very interesting.
Yeah, they're. I couldn't find anything comparable to hers, so that's something if she wants, she
does
can
that
email.
Kind of stuff go? Like, the, I mean, we're talking like really interesting china or ornate bowls, sugar bowls.
Yeah, usually like alabaster is pretty, pretty high up there. Like the lamps and stuff can be in the 1500, mm-hmm. 2000 and up. But the bowls, I can't tell you offhand.
All right, 312-981-7200. 815 says, hey, tell that guy, I forgot, what is it, Jeff? Tell that guy to contact someone to archive those press notes.
Yeah, the Jack Brickhouse notes.
Yeah, those need to be archived. They're emphatic. 815 is mad. those notes should be archived. Please tell him to contact someone to archive those notes.
Okay.
There's a double archive.
Okay.
I just, there's something great about, what Scott Simon was saying, that like you finished the broadcast. It was all day games,
mm-hmm.
And they finished the broadcast and they're like, well, let's walk a door over and get a drink at the bar, the Wrigley Bar.
Yeah, that's had to be kind of a secret club thing that they had, because I've never heard of it.
And I always wonder, too, just about the idea that that's a different time now. Obviously at that time, it was just like there wasn't so much celebrity adoration around the players, so the broadcasters could be done and they could just roll to the bar.
Well, we would hear the stories how players would go across the street to a bar.
Yeah, right.
But I've never heard like within the
bar inside. Yeah. I'm sure there are. I'm sure there's press bars up in the, like, I haven't spent any time in the press box or press area. We can ask Mark or Kevin or Sam next time they're on about what the bars are like at Wrigley Field. Yeah. Oh, thrilling, riveting conversation we'll have with them about that.
Right.
847 says, I got a Princess Diana Beanie Baby.
Oh, here we go.
I've seen them online from $5 to $100,000. What?
Yeah.
What's the real value?
Again, it's there's like a four-stage process you have to kind of verify. Again, it was the spacing of like the poem or the writing on the back of the tag. There was then what they called the butt tag, the tag that's on the butt of the, that had to have like a star, a white star and a red heart or something. I just don't even bother. It's just, it's kind of like,
you have to have all these things for it to be a collectible.
Yeah. You have to verify that to even,
do they have
$5
a Princess Diana Beanie Baby that might be a collector's item and another one that's not? You know what I mean? Like it's the same thing, but they don't have the right markings. So
like that and the purple bear one, I can't remember, but that one, like, it depends where it was made as well. Was it Indonesia? Was it Malaysia? I mean, there's a four step, and if you just Google that, they have pages that are dedicated to how to identify your Beanie Baby.
Hmm. There you go. How to identify your Beanie Baby. If you're watching this, you need an issue with identifying your Beanie Baby. I've got a Kerry Wood signed jersey purchased from Wrigley Field.
Okay.
Also a Walter Payton jersey in a photo picture frame.
Yeah, the Payton jerseys, if they're authenticated, with the grading, they go as high as 1500. If they're not graded and it's just kind of the jersey just framed, 300.
Hmm.
But yeah, Kerry,
it's a class. I sent a picture too. It's classic Payton. Classic. Yeah, he was. I mean, I have a feeling there are a lot of Payton jerseys and things like that.
Yeah, I would think. Yeah.
And he says, 847, when talking about the Kerry Wood jersey, says it was a signed jersey purchased from Wrigley that on the day he retired.
Oh, wow.
Kerry Wood.
Hmm.
So I'm not sure what that is. But.
Yeah.
And yes, the Walter Payton jersey is signed.
Is it a home or away jersey? I would think the white would stick out more like a sign.
No, it's a home. It's a blue.
Yeah, blue is harder to see probably, unless he signed it in the numbers, I guess.
No, he did. He signed it in the numbers.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. So there you go. All right, well, this is Swap Meet. It's a little truncated tonight, of course, because of the weather storm the severe thunderstorms that have come through the area, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But Greg Flamm here every Wednesday doing Swap Meet at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter. Once again, like I said, truncated tonight, but we got some good stuff in.
That's good. We got it in.
All right. Good to see you. We'll see you next Wednesday.
All right. Thanks, Justin.
All right. So we're going to go to Rob Martier in just a moment here. Before we do that, let's just update you on the weather. Patty Vasquez coming up after Rob. She'll take over tonight here on 720 WGN. As we've been saying all night, there has been the severe weather warnings on the northern part of the state. But now it's sort of because of this long stretch of thin storms has really stretched across everything from all the way down to Peoria. Up to Janesville. And as the severe weather moves through the area, we have moved out of a tornado warning. We saw the tornado warning, which is citing tornadoes, in the McHenry County, Boone County area, northern Wisconsin, as well as northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin, southeast Wisconsin. Now we are fully into a straight-up severe thunderstorm warning. And this is for pretty much all of the Chicago area, Elgin, Aurora. We're going to get some stuff from Joliet. I wouldn't be surprised if the thunderstorms go through Kankakee in that area. Of course, Chicago, Cook County, Racine, all the way up. I mean, essentially, this band of storms is moving towards the lake. And like I said, it is thin and it stretches across the Chicago area region. And if you're in McHenry County or even in Rockford, it's already through. Although someone could text up right now and say, no, it's not. But just looking at the radar, it looks like it has moved through. So it's interesting because all of the television, local television, has kept their broadcasting on, seemingly for another couple minutes at least, to keep people updated on the severe weather that's coming through the area. That's all the local stations, which I admire. The fact that, you know, they're bumping the Tonight Show and moving some of those shows back to give you breaking news on the weather. But like I said, right now, really a severe weather, a severe thunderstorm night. It had the potential to be a very dangerous night, especially with tornado warnings and the storms that were coming through and the wind and the kind of storms that they were. I think that there's a lot of concern on the part of meteorologists that this would be something that would definitely create dangerous weather. And we're seeing it with warnings. But as it moves through, be ready to brace yourself for some of the towns that are in western Cook County, DuPage, Lake, Kendall, all the way through there. I think that all of those essentially are under warning. Right, Rob?
They are indeed. You hit the nail on that. Justin, that's a very good assessment of...
They're all. Everything is under warning.
It's coming your way.
It's coming your way.
You can't get out of the way.